Welcome. The House Transportation and Regional Governance Policy Committee will come to order. And we do have a quorum, so I have to ask Representative Hornstein at least once during committee to move the minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've moved the minutes from our previous meeting.
All right. Thank you. Representative Hornstein moves approval of the minutes from the February 15th meeting. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. All right. We have a number of bills today and pertaining to the Met Council. So our first bill is Representatives Albright's bill, House File 828. And we'll ask you to come to the witness table. Representative, thank you very much for being here and bringing your bill. And I will move that Representatives Albright's 828 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. So, and I see you have an author's amendment, Representative.
I do, Madam Chair. If someone could move that amendment to put the bill in the shape that I would prefer, that I would appreciate it.
I'll move the A4 amendment, members. And those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Both same sign. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, and for the benefit of the members, the amendment that was just put on to file House File 828 basically just moves the effective date from 2018 to 2019 and actually makes more succinct and clarifies the language in terms of the appointment of a couple of the members of the committee. There was some vagary in the language preceding the amendment in terms of the number of members that were to be appointed from the various functions of government. So appreciate that.
Thank you. Do you want to go ahead and brief us on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I sit before you today much akin to where we started this conversation a year ago or better, with regard to the governance structure that is incumbent upon the Met Council. And so today what I am hopeful for is the beginning of a robust discussion on that topic that continues to draw the interest of you as members and the public at large to the point of the governance structure of the Metropolitan Council. Let me first note that House File 828, as it sits before you amended, recognizes the important role that the Met Council does play in guiding the region's growth and providing vital regional services. That is the premise behind this bipartisan legislation. A strong regional governing body is critical to maintaining and strengthening the vitality of the metropolitan region. I also want to note for those around the table as well as those that are listening that this is a bill that has discussion and is for discussion, is not focused on any one administration or specifically to any appointed council members. This legislation is a response to a continuing growth of the concern with the lack of credibility and or the factor of trust between the Met Council, local elected officials, and public stakeholders. The Office of the Legislative Office Auditor issued a report in January of 2011 following the 8 years of the Pawlenty administration that noted addressing the structure of the Met Council is the first step. I want to stress that again, the first step towards improving the governance of transit in the region, and concluded that the problems with the governance of transit stem partly from having an appointed Met Council. Last year, the Citizens League convened a task force after acknowledging media reports were bringing increasing public attention to concerns about the Met Council that had been simmering for years. We were in the process of moving that forward, Madam Chair, and we continue to move those governance referendums and issues forward in this bill. And with that, I do have testifiers, Madam Chair, that would like to come forward and give their perspective on the bill and on the Met Council. And with your indulgence, I would ask that you call them forward at this time.
Very good, Representative Albright. We'll just go one by one, I think. We have Jim Hovland, Mayor, City of Edina. Following him would be Myron Bailey, Mayor, City of Cottage Grove. Are those two folks here?
Here, Madam Chair.
There. Please come to the witness stand and And who is going first then?
Ms. Nauman is going first, Madam Chair.
All right, very good. Welcome, Ms. Nauman.
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. Metro Cities represents 90 cities in the metropolitan area, both before the legislature and the Metropolitan Council. Metro Cities is a region-wide entity and the only regional organization representing the collective interests of cities at the Metropolitan Council. Metro Cities does respectfully oppose House File 828 today that would make up the Metropolitan Council of Local Officials. Metro Cities has looked at the issue of regional governance in some depth over the last several years, including holding a task force on the subject and having the discussion of governance be held at our policy committee process every year. These discussions have resulted in a number of recommendations to improve governance and specific opposition to this particular model of governance for the council for the following reasons. Holding dual offices on two local political subdivisions, cities and our membership have, when they looked at this issue, considered the inherent incompatibilities of having city officials hold a dual office as a Metropolitan Council member. A couple of examples of that are that the council does serve as a regulating body. Cities are regulated by it. Cities often apply for grants from the Metropolitan Council, so they would be both in the position of distributing grants and applying for grants and serving in those dual roles. Cities also, particularly in our task force, looked at the issue of where a local officials' fiduciary obligations reside, and that is to the community to which they are elected. If a city official is elected to a community and then ends up serving, say, 10 or 15 others on the Metropolitan Council, that brings into question the potential for divided loyalties when those officials are called into making decisions for regional investments, funding, and policy. The result, which could be some very significant potential consequences for those city officials as well as other communities in the region who are dependent upon the services that a regional government provides. The city officials in our membership through the task force and subsequent policy vetting process have also looked at the potential for this model to undermine the ability of a regional body to make effective decisions or the efficient and high-quality provision of regional-level infrastructure, again, upon which the region's residents and businesses rely. The other issue that cities have identified with having a Metropolitan Council that is made up of local officials is that unlike county officials, city officials, with a few exceptions, are not full-time. They do not serve full-time in those roles. City councils, officials and mayors often have full-time jobs. In addition to their city council duties, they're often on HRAs or planning commissions or other civic bodies within their community. We would now be asking them to take on the role of a Metropolitan Council, which in and of itself is about, from what I understand, a 20 to 30-hour-a-week position. Metro Cities does support some improvements. Certainly as an organization, we take many policy positions related to the Metropolitan Council and strive to have policies that support strong collaboration between the Metropolitan Council and city officials, as well as a strong sense of partnership. And to that extent, we do support changes to the governance, for example, staggered terms and more transparency around the nominating committee process. I know that the positions of Metro Cities are consistent with the positions taken by the Citizens League and their recent task force. But again, we do not support making up the council of local officials. I'll turn it over to Mayor Hovland.
All right, very good. Welcome, Mayor Hovland.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please give us your name and
My name is Jim Hovland, H-O-V-L-A-N-D. I'm the mayor of Edina. I've been the mayor for 12 years. I've also been a TAB member for about that same period of time. And the last 2 years I've served as the chair of the TAB, so I can give you a little historical perspective here. When I first got on the TAB, I thought, wait a minute, wouldn't it work better to have a council of governments kind of model like Representative Albrecht is proposing? Over time, I've learned that what we have, just by serendipity, which was the fact that the Met Council was appointed, The federal government likes their municipal planning organizations to be elected officials, at least a majority of them. From that requirement, the tab was created, which is composed of a primarily elected officials, a majority elected officials, with citizen reps, about 34 in number, to be advisory to the Met Council. That model was approved by the federal government as an acceptable governance model. So over time, what I've come to appreciate is the beauty of that sort of serendipitous situation. Here you have a tab that's advisory to the Met Council. So if we reconstruct the Met Council, you're now going to have a situation where the tab members, for example, that are elected officials, sit in an advisory capacity to the Met Council. Now all of a sudden, the Met Council is composed of elected officials that are local in nature or county in nature that are regulators, because the Met Council is a regulator and cities are the regulated. Now you put somebody in a position where they're both the regulator and the regulated. Very, very difficult situations could arise because of that. I think that's one of the key things that you need to think about. Do you really want to put local elected officials and county officials in a position where they're both the regulator and potentially the regulated, and what kind of conflicts of interest could that create? The second thing is, from sitting on the tab for over a decade, I can tell you that the workload is tremendous. For some of us, we feel like we have two full-time jobs, mayors in particular, in serving our region, serving our communities, and also trying to make a living. I don't think, from observing what's happened on the tab over the last decade, that you can have local elected officials both serving in a local elected capacity and also spending 20 to 30 hours doing the work of the Met Council. I just don't think schedules are permitted, and the compensation isn't sufficient to take care of that either. So those are the two key things that I would stress that are real danger points here. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater here. We can always do better. We can find a better governance model. I think the Citizens League work that was done last year is a great step towards that, because this area is extraordinarily complicated. With the new acronyms that you need to learn, transportation finance jargon you need to learn, it would be very valuable to have staggered terms for the members of the Met Council that are coming on board appointed by a governor, so that you have that transition where people can actually learn from people that are there and they get up to speed quicker on doing the things that are important for the region. The second thing is, if you want to have local officials more involved in the appointment process, I think that's a good thing too, and I think any governor, Republican or Democrat, would appreciate that input locally. It also creates more transparency in what's occurring with respect to that appointment process, and I think that's always a good thing too. So those two things to be aware of, the fact that local elected officials can't really absorb this level of workload on top of what they're doing and also trying to make a living. And then I think the more inherent danger is, do you really want the regulators to also be the regulated? That's a very, very dangerous area. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Hovland. We do have a question, so let's take that one. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Mayor, I appreciate your input here. And I just want to be clear that I understood what you just said. What you just talked about was that the elected officials, the city officials, are the regulated, and the Met Council and TAB and other are the regulators. It seems to me that's a little backwards. We have elected officials that are being regulated by officials that are not being elected. It seems to me that we would want, for protection of the citizens and the voters, that the citizens and the voters ought to be electing the regulators, and that the agencies and others should be the ones that are regulated. It seems to me this is backwards. Now, is that what you were saying, is that you want public officials to be regulated by a non-public entity?
We have that situation now.
Mayor Hovland.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. We have that situation now, and it actually works quite beautifully. With the Met Council functioning the way it does, and regulating local government, it's the beauty of that situation is that you're not putting an elected official like me in the position of sitting on the regulating body and also making decisions for what happens in Edina. And I have to make a decision as to whether or not, as an elected official, I think it's a good idea for Edina. There are other ways that local elected officials can push back on this notion of the existing structure on the Met Council and represent themselves. But at least you're not putting a local elected official in a potential conflict situation with respect to a matter that could affect both bodies, or how the Met Council regulates the local government. So in my view of the world, and your view of the world is one that takes place other places. You know, I mean, you think of the Denver Council of Governments. That's the way that functions. But I do think there's some beauty in the way we operate right now. And I can tell you the TAB is extraordinarily efficient in the work that it does, and it's always got regional interests in mind. And so we work in this, and I think part of that is because we work in an advisory capacity as opposed to a distinctly self-interest capacity. And it's been, I think, quite an effective model.
All right. Thank you, Mayor.
Ma'am, just follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I certainly understand it, and I don't know if this is the right direction bill to go or not, but you're talking about the way that it works well at this point. And it sounds like it works well in regards to your position. The question we should always be asking for is does it work well for the taxpayer? You know, as an elected official, if you have somebody else that regulates things for you, pretty much takes decisions out of your hand, and you also then don't have to be accountable to the taxpayer. But ultimately, we all have to be responsible for the taxpayer, who has an opportunity through their vote and others to be able to determine the direction they want to go. When a regulator is out of that process, then there is no control by the local electorate and those that are involved to really be have input and be able to determine the direction that they want the regulators to do it. And with the regulated, where the elected officials also not having to worry about the consequences of the voter because it's out of their hands, I can understand where that may be valuable, but I'm not sure that's best for our local voters and those others. And so I would just question, you know, whether or not this is some self-serving, but also is this the best interest of the voter itself?
Yeah, well, that's a fair question, I think. I would tell you that,
Chair Hovland.
Madam Chair, excuse me, thank you. I would just observe that with respect to the Met Council representatives that represent districts now, for instance, the one that represents Edina represents part of Bloomington, Richfield, if we have issues that are of concern to us, we go to that person and we work with them with respect to any potential affect from a regulatory standpoint that might affect us. But if I'm sitting on the, or one of our council members is sitting on the Met Council, and I think the proposed pay was $20,000 a year, and they're getting $10,000 a year at the city of Edina, does that just inherently create some potential for conflict for that particular person? And also, is that in the best interest of the taxpayer? Because right now, you're not paying any city council member or any mayor that sits on the TAB anything other than mileage. So if you're looking for the best bang for the buck, it's the model we have right now from a cost standpoint.
So Representative Albright and members, I'm going to just take a quick couple minutes here, and let's have Deborah Dyson, our House research person, give us a quick rundown of the provisions in the bill so we all know just what we're debating here.
Ms. Dyson? Madam Chair and members of the committee, the bill basically restructures the Metropolitan Council from 16 members appointed by the governor from districts to 27 members consisting of 23 local elected officials, city and county, and four other members representing modes of transportation and the Commissioner of Transportation. For the 23 local elected officials, there's each county board of the seven counties in the metropolitan area appoints one of their members to the Metropolitan Council. And then there are still 16 districts, and there's a municipal committee made up of representatives of city councils in those districts that would, from among the cities that are on the municipal district, they would appoint one of their members to serve on the council. And then the municipal committees are also directed to meet at least quarterly to discuss matters of interest regionally. And then you have the Commissioner of Transportation and the three other modes of transportation represented. The bill specifically states that the local elected offices are compatible with serving on the Metropolitan Council. The terms are generally for 2 years, but a term would be, or an office would be determined to be vacant if a person no longer is serving as an elected local official. The bill also provides for $20,000 per year compensation for the members, and then $40,000 for the chair. And this is in addition to any pay the local elected official receives as a local elected official. The Commissioner of Transportation does not receive any additional compensation, but is eligible for reimbursement for expenses. The bill, a lot of the language that's stricken out relates to the nominating process for the appointment by the governor. The redistricting provision is a technical change to correspondent to the rest of the bill, but there's still the decennial redistricting of the 16 districts. The chair is appointed by the members of this restructured council by and from among the members to serve a one-year term. And then the voting, this is in subdivision 9 on page 5 of the bill. The voting is divided up. It basically, it says a quorum is a majority of the members that are permitted to vote on a matter. And then it specifies that the members that are appointed to the council when it's serving in the capacity as the Metropolitan Planning Organization, the MPO, that all of them get to vote. That includes the Commissioner of Transportation and the Commissioner's appointees. But otherwise, those four members do not vote on matters before the council. And then for levying and adopting system plans or plan amendments, the requirement is a 60% vote. And finally, this is effective in January 1st of 2019 and provides for the current members, or what would be then the current members of the Metropolitan Council who are serving, that they stay there until all new members are appointed. Then finally, in Section 2 of the bill, the Transportation Advisory Board is eliminated. Madam Chair, that's the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Dyson. That helps. We have a question from Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I just want to point out, and I was trying to follow the exchange between Mayor Hovland and Representative Petersburg. Kind of ended up being a lot of who's on first and who's on second. But from what I understand, if you in a metropolitan district, there could be more than one city. So those cities would get together. Let's just say for a math sake that there's three cities in one metropolitan district. Those three cities would get together and appoint one person to the Met Council. Let's say that person is from one city, obviously, and an issue comes before the Met Council where two-thirds of this district, the other two cities, agree with what the Met Council is doing, and his city, that or her city, that third doesn't. That's just the ultimate conflict of interest. Who is that person really serving? They've been elected to serve in their city, but then appointed to put on this regional body, and I just don't see anything but a mess coming out of that. I'm not opposed to electing folks to the Met Council. I just don't think this is the mechanism that we should be doing it, because current electeds, not only are they representing their own city, the majority of them run their own businesses, they work other full-time jobs, they're raising a family. So putting this on top of that as like a third job, and let's say then they're also appointed to the TAB, you just get into some really crazy lines of conflict of interest that I think is what Mayor Hovland was trying to explain. So thank you.
Thank you. I didn't hear a question there.
No,
so, all right, thanks. So we'll proceed then with the next testifier, and please give us your name for the record.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson Runbeck and committee members. My name is Myron Bailey, and I'm the mayor of Cottage Grove. I'm here to testify in opposition to House File 828 Albright, which proposes making up the Metropolitan Council of City and County Officials. This bill has been vetted by Metro Cities and consistently not supported. Due to the incompatibilities of these offices, as noted by Metro Cities here today, and the impracticality of asking city officials to take on this role. I can speak personally to this concern, as I have a full-time job outside of being a mayor, which, frankly, can be a full-time job in a lot of cases. And I would find it extremely difficult to be an elected official and try to hold down a full-time job outside of being a mayor, part-time, as we say, and then, again, a part-time position on, say, the Met Council. I would also like to speak to additional concerns about the high possibility that this model of governance would result in a more, and frankly, political body, which has the potential serious implications for provisions of cost-effective regional infrastructure and services for communities across the seven-county metro area. We rely on efficient, high-quality, balanced regional infrastructure and services. The potential to undermine the provision of these services should not be underestimated as you consider this type of governance change. It's not clear how this change best serves our region as we strive to become more competitive in the global economy. Our Metropolitan Council is not perfect, and cities do not agree with everything the Council does, and I would tell you I don't agree with everything that the Met Council does. But there are mechanisms in place to address tensions and conflicts, and by the large and by and large, cities and the council do this well on a day-to-day basis. Changes like staggered terms and making the selection process more transparent would be good and practical changes that cities can support for the governance of the council. This governance model goes far beyond those changes and could have many negative consequences, however unintentionally it may be, for the regional government and, frankly, the communities that they serve. And so, again, I urge you to oppose House File 828, and I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Bailey. And we have two other testifiers, at least, on the
Madam
here.
Chair, I think I'll take this opportunity maybe to respond to some of the comments made by the testifiers thus far, and also request that I did have a testifier, Dakota County Commissioner Chris Gerlach, to come down. I know that he has some comments that he'd like to share with the committee as well. But to that point, you've heard some comments with regard to dual offices. You've heard some comments made with regard to the fiduciary responsibility. Well, recognizing that the Met Council serves both a regional as well as a parochial function, I think that the same could be said for any number of instances where we as state representatives have to not only deal with our own constituents but also those of a statewide variety. So to render that point as being effective in the debate here, I think, is rendered somewhat moot. Also, the dual offices concern. No one is asking anyone of requiring any of the elected officials in their municipality or county to step up. This is an opportunity for them to do so. And so out of, in some cases, you know, six or eight members to a local municipal board, we're inviting one to consider that opportunity. This is not an obligation. And so in light of the fact that there's the impression that we are all already overburdened with responsibilities, whether it be from family, from business, or from our responsibilities to our municipality, I think that goes beyond the pale in terms of suggesting that everyone has the same level of responsibilities and does not also take into consideration the desire to participate in metropolitan governance activities as well. So to that point, I would just refute some of those concerns. You know, the time commitment, you've heard about that. This is a job of a significant undertaking, and no one should go into it with their eyes shut. But that being said, I'll refer back to my earlier point in terms of this is an invitation across the metropolitan body for people of anyone who holds an election certificate to step up and make themselves available to serve on this body. Serendipitous, I've heard that word a couple times. With the consideration of the MPO, whether it be held by the TAB or whether it be held in the concert with the Met Council itself. There was a report provided by the Fed Transportation Committee not too long ago that suggested at the very bottom of their dissertation back to us that they would prefer that the Met Council have locally elected officials on their board. And that was coming from the Federal Transportation Commission. Whether that is a function of the TAB, which I would suggest is an alteration on the true and initial intent of the Met Council, we have unelected people doing the business of our constituents, and it needs to be remedied. And so with that, I would look forward to hearing testimony from Commissioner Gerlach.
Very good. Commissioner Gerlach, and do I understand then that Wendy Wolf is in the room or not?
I'm not aware.
Okay. Good afternoon, Commissioner Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Chris Gerlach. I'm a Dakota County Commissioner, and I have been participating in a group of other county commissioners from Anoka, Carver, Scott County, as well as many other city council members and mayors from local governments that all have been trying to solve a common problem. I'm here to speak strongly in favor of this bill. And if I could, I'd hope to actually help tee this up at the beginning before we heard some of the issues with it. But I'm going to change my testimony a little bit and try to pinch in a little bit here. And if I could, I want to reel us back to what is the problem we're trying to solve. Every bill you have before you should take a look at that and say, what is House File 828 trying to solve? And I will put that in a nutshell for you. There is a very strong disconnect between many local governments and the Metropolitan Council that has evolved over decades. Many local governments feel disenfranchised, cut out, on the outside looking in, because the way the appointment process works is it has become narrowed so much. Of course, 50 years ago, when it was just a simple planning organization, gubernatorial appointments, that's fine. Then, of course, as budgets increased, staff increased, responsibilities increased, it became a large organization. And at the same time, we continued to narrow the political control of the Metropolitan Council in 1994 with the legislation that combined the Regional Transit Board and others that made the terms coterminous with the governor, which further meant that the governor has further control over the Met Council and will wipe the slate every time a new governor comes in. There's no question today that everyone, pretty much everyone, views the Met Council as simply a state agency. It is the Department of Military of Metropolitan Affairs, and it has a department commissioner, the chair. That's how it's run. You have certainly have a group of very capable and good public servants on the Met Council to handle a lot of day-to-day things, but the big questions and the big issues are controlled from the executive branch and the governor's office with complete control over that appointment process. And that has shut out lots of local governments. This bill is about democratizing the Met Council, about taking it from a top-down, narrowly constricted political control to a broad-based, bottom-up appointment process to disperse the accountability and to disperse who these folks are answerable to. Rather than one person with one political point of view, it becomes an open democratic process that is spread across the region so that everybody has a fair shot at least being heard. And at the end of the day, through a oftentimes messy, chaotic, but beautiful democratic process, we will end up with a vote and have had our say in what's going on in our regional governance. Right now, it is far too narrowly political controlled by the governor, and that's what this bill gets to. Other proposals that will say, well, staggered terms. Staggered terms is fine if the governor retains appointing authority, and it's great for institutional stability, but it's just an aspirin when the patient suffers from a much more grievous illness. Changes to the nominations process. Great. Again, if the governor is going to retain all that power, you'd want to do that. But are you really saying that there's no problem with that governance structure, that it's just nibbling around the edges and that will solve the problem? I'm telling you, there's a whole lot of folks that believe that a more substantial reform is needed than just those changes, which are fine, but don't go far enough. So this group of county commissioners from those suburban counties, as well as many city officials, got together. We formed last year, you may remember, we were talking about various principles we had defined. Then we took that this last fall, and we put meat on the bones and produced a series of ideas, which is not perfect, but I'd like to thank Representative Albright for his willingness to look at the issue and willingness to be the author here and present that. We don't have enough time, but I could certainly go item by item and offer up refutations for many of the arguments, but I know we don't have time for that. Happy to talk with anybody offline with any specific questions or take any now.
Madam Chair and members, to that point that Commissioner Gerlach expressed in your packets, along with the language of the House file, you'll notice a handout, Metro Governance Transparency Initiative. And I would just go to the point of the inclusion of the stakeholders down the right-hand column of the community supporting these principles. And for most of you that are sitting around this table and for many of the folks in the audience, you probably will recognize a number of the names that are on that right-hand column as people that are in support of this and have offered up resolutions within their community structure to support the initiatives that you see as a starting point in House Bill 828. So it is not narrow. It is not a group or a collection in the minority, quite the opposite. It is a growing a collection and a growing group of people that feel that their voice is not being representative on the Met Council, and they want to support the initiatives to right that ship.
Very good. We do have one last testifier, Mr. Shetton, and then we'll go to some of the questions that folks have. To that point, Representative?
Thank you, Chair Runbeck. I actually have a question for this testifier. Will you be calling folks back down then, or would you like those questions?
I think, Commissioner, you'll stay around for questions, will you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Shetland? Welcome to the committee. Please give us your name for the record and...
Great. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Judd Shetland. I'm the Council's Government Affairs Director, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here to talk about House File 828. And a lot of the conversation that has already been discussed from some of the local elected officials, I'm not going to cover that ground. But we do have a couple concerns, and one of them relates to an amendment, so maybe I'll come back and speak to the A2 amendment in a little bit. But as far as where the council is related to this bill, it's ultimately really is a decision to be made by the legislature and the governor, since the council really is a creature of the legislature. But the fact is that there are some real concerns related to regionalism, and if you have that incompatibility of office, and I know that Representative Albright has mentioned that this is an issue that he thinks can be resolved as far as how the council works. But we have current statute that relates to the Parks and Open Space Commission, which is an advisory committee to the council, that says a council member cannot serve on that commission specifically because there is concern about conflict. Now, if you take that and bring that out further and apply that to a council member who's serving as an elected official and then also serves as a locally elected official, either as a county member or as a city council member, it's hard to see how that wouldn't apply there as well. What the council really tries to look for is regional government, and regional perspective on large infrastructure type projects, and that concern related to that incompatibility of office really is there. We also have some concerns about the parochialism that comes across. I know that was mentioned eloquently by some folks, but I just think the county, the legislature really needs to think about this as well. And I'm just going to speak real briefly to the A2 amendment just ahead of time here. That
Mr. Chetanen, no, I think that's not coming up today.
Well, then let me add one other thing. Currently, the legislature has a lot of oversight related to the council. Not only does the Senate approve or confirm the council members, there is a statutorily required nominating committee that is put into place in order to bring these folks forward. But the legislature back in 2001 created the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Governance. It's Minnesota Statute 3.8441, I believe, that there are 14 metropolitan area members of the legislature, four in the majority of the House, three in the minority, four in the majority of the Senate, and three in the minority, whose explicit job is to review the council's capital and operating budget. And so when we have this conversation about the council and not having this disconnect between cities, counties, and the legislature, I really think that the council has more oversight than most agencies and most government does when we have that group that it's their explicit job to do that. And I know personally, because I do this, I send every member a copy of our draft budget every August, September, October, and then we have a meeting sometime between October and December before the council adopts the budget to review all of this information. And so I just want the committee and members to recognize that there is oversight. There are opportunities for the cities and counties to work with the council on these things. But really, again, it is going to be a decision between the legislature and the governor. But just take a long, hard look about making sure that that regional perspective is there, because when you turn the corner and start having elected officials serve in what was mentioned earlier, the regulated and the regulators, it gets potentially a little too close for comfort there.
Thank you, Mr. Chetanen. So we do have questions. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, and I have a question for Mayor Bailey and Mr. Gerlach. So you have detailed that there's a committee that oversees the council's budget, but how is that legislative oversight if the legislature really doesn't control that budget?
Mr. Chairman.
Madam Chair, Representative Hertas, I would say that we come to the legislature every 2 years related to the state funds that go into the council's operations that work through the state, and have that debate every year in the transportation bill or in the bonding bill. We also work with cities and counties, or cities in particular, when we set our municipal wastewater charge. We work with communities throughout the region and have public meetings where we work specifically with those folks related to that. We also have the SAC work group that we talked about in this committee where we talk about the impacts of SAC throughout the region. In fact, we had two folks, one from Shoreview and one from, who that was, who came and said what a great working relationship we have with them on that. Related to the council's budget, the legislature and has the opportunity to review, advise, and comment and work with the council on anything they want related to the council's budget. It's there in statute. I can't compel the legislature to do that, but there are 14 members who are members of that committee who are able to come and hold those hearings and have those conversations. And I can tell you that...
Mr. Shetnin, thank you. Did you want to follow up, Representative?
I did. Thank you. But even though there is that committee, what veto power does that committee have over their budget?
Mr. Shetnin.
Madam Chair and Representative Hertas, the way that we bring our budget forward is just how any other local government would do that. We have a truth and taxation hearing. Prior to even doing all that, however, we do prepare a budget process that we bring forward. And so how, when we want to talk about the funds specific to the state, we negotiate that through the transportation bill. We receive our motor vehicle sales tax. We receive our general fund. We receive our regional transit capital bonds. We receive our general obligation bonds. And all of those are built into our annual operating dollars, but also into our six-year capital improvement program when we talk about bigger projects. It's also important to remember that some of the funds that we receive that are put into our budget come from our partners at CTIB or other local governments that come in and provide us dollars toward projects like the Southwest Line or projects like the Orange Line in Representative Kosnick's district or projects like the A-Line bus system. So I think that there is, and then also we spend an awful lot of time in front of the legislative committees having these conversations as well. And so I think that there is a lot of opportunity for the legislature to weigh in and have that opportunity be, and specifically related to the Met Council, the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Governance is a major opportunity for the legislature to weigh in on the council's overall operations and budget.
So thank you. And members, I'm going to just remind you, we do have five bills to get through, and we're going to do that unless we all want to come back tonight. So we want to move on to the next question?
I do, Mayor Bailey. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hertas.
Mayor Bailey, you mentioned you're the mayor of Cottage Grove. I'm curious, could you tell me how much of your community is developed? Is it completely developed? Is it 80% developed, partially developed? How would you describe the development pattern of the growth of your community?
Mayor Bailey?
Madam Chair, Commissioner, I just wanted to mention that Cottage Grove is probably about 50% developed at this point. And obviously we're just in the process of going through the comp plan and looking at expanding the urban services areas to cover more territory.
Madam Chair.
Hertas, follow up?
Yes, well, thank you. So you mentioned earlier that there are some things that you agree with and some things you disagree with. Could you expand a little bit for me, please, and the committee on the policies or the interactions with the Met Council as it relates to Cottage Grove and what you disagree with?
Well,
Mr. Mayor.
Madam Chair, sorry. I just wanted to mention that from the local, the Met Council and the perspective of us locally, one of the, I guess, the challenges that I see is if you create this position where you're going to have elected officials on the Met Council, I'm concerned that it'll become more political. For example, I'm in the East Metro, and the East Metro is just, with all respect to my West Metro friends, is really starting to grow. And I'm concerned that the vote, if you want to call it that, would be of a concern to me, that there would be a lot of pressures to not necessarily be fair in divvying out some of the funding and such for road projects, infrastructure needs, and so on. That would be one of my major concerns. I do think that it would be good to have staggered terms. That was one item that I was very specific about. I don't think that we should have people that are on there, you know, forever, I guess would be another item, personally speaking. But when it comes to the Met Council, we've actually had a good working relationship in Cottage Grove with them. as we deal with them on our wastewater needs specifically, and then working again on some additional opportunities for transit within our market area.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hertas, and then we'll have to go on.
Thank you. Well, so you've alluded to the fact that you're concerned about your being an East Metro community and the dollars or funds that the Met Council may or may not allocate. I've heard from a number of mayors around the metropolitan region that are a little bit worried about the relationship and the tension that's created, maybe perhaps through coercion in terms of getting those dollars, and your being compliant with visions and goals of a comprehensive plan. Do you feel that you have that type of dynamic going on amongst you and your council members with regard to your comprehensive plan updates, and whether or not there's coercion in terms of cooperating with those plans, even though they may differ from your vision of your community as you represent the people in your community? Do you find that, that there's a tension there?
Mayor Bailey.
Madam Chair and Representative, I would tell you that there's always going to be some type of, I guess, animosity there with any type of particular situation, in this case, the Met Council. I'll give you a personal example. As mayor of Cottage Grove, and this is going to sound kind of funny, but people will say, you know what, mayor, we need a Buffalo Wild Wings. And they'll tell me that they need it, and they're mad at me for not getting it for them. But when it comes to the same thing with the Met Council, we need to have them, and they can't do everything for us. My particular take on all of this with them is that I don't see the animosity at all. I do think that they get put in that tenuous position that they have to look at the overall needs within the Seven County metro area, and that's where I think is the best suited. I would prefer not to see certain groups get in there and have some political desire to move a project in one area or the other. That's me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll yield the rest of my questions to the testifiers. I know we've got a tight agenda, so thank you.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a few comments, and then if anybody would like to respond to that. I did serve on a city council, and my experience with Met Council goes from being very upset to very, very good. And I do believe we do need a metro regional planning agency. I think the comments have already been made about why it makes it really difficult for a city council member to serve on this. I mean, that totally is a conflict of interest. I just don't see how you can get around that. But I do believe that I could see where the local governments, the city councils, the county commissioners would have more of an impact on selecting the council members, the Met Council members, because you do need to have a really good working relationship. And as I said, I have served in years where there was not any relationship. It was all the governor did the appointing, and that was the end of it. So I can see where we can make some improvements. But what I see in this bill is way overboard, and it's incredibly dramatic.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I actually have a question for Commissioner Gerlach. Maybe actually for Judge Shetnin as well, just trying to understand something real quick. And it's actually probably for Mr. Shetnin first.
There's a slide over.
Mr. Shetnin, it's my understanding that the districts for Met Council are a portion per population. Is that correct?
Right.
Shannon.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Uwekum. Yes, they are. The council districts are set every year after the decennial census. So every year ending in 3, the council resets its council districts. And currently right now, a council district is about the size of 2 to 2.5 Senate districts. So we have 16 council seats. The chair serves at large. But each council member serves an area that makes up about 2 to 2.5 Senate districts.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner Gerlach, could you tell me the population of Dakota County?
roughly.
Commissioner Gerlach.
Madam Chair, just a little over 400,000, about 410, 415,000.
Thank you.
Representative,
you thank you, Chair Runbeck. Commissioner Gerlach, I can speak for Hennepin County. We're at about 1.2 million. This bill on lines 1.12, 1.13, and then 2.17 to 2.21 mentions appointing a commissioner from each of the counties. So my concern is that would greatly outbalance and give you, and I could see why Dakota County would like it, because you'd have the same voting power as a county that has three times your size. So I'm a little bit worried when we've, you know, crafted the districts to go by population, that by adding in county commissioners, that you're really giving people a little bit more say than their population occurs. So that was just my question about population size. Thank you.
Mr. Gerlach.
Oh, if I could, Madam Chair, and to respond to that, you're right, no model is perfect. And much like, as I mentioned this morning when we had our press event, and this question came up as well, how do you get equal representation across the board when you have populations and you have political jurisdictions? And it's no different than in the 1780s when they're drafting the federal constitution, when they said, we've got New York and we've got Rhode Island, we've got big states and small states, how in the world are we going to do that? Now, their solution is not what we're proposing, which was a bicameral where you had two and of course, two in the Senate and the rest based on population. This is a unicameral body, if you will, like a city council or something, and so you can't really do that, but this is sort of a blending of the two. You have some of those, you could look at it as the counties sort of being the states, you know, and you've got a limit or the same amount of representation coming from those, but then you have a whole bunch of, there's more than two, to, it's more than a two-to-one margin of different city officials coming from all over, and many of those would be from the Minneapolis, St. Paul, or Hennepin and Ramsey County, and you would have a lot, and overall, that'll balance it up, but it's a blending of the two things, solving the population and political jurisdiction problem together.
Any follow-up, Representative?
Thank you, thank you, Chair. That was a little more editorializing than the question I actually asked. But, no, that's one of my concerns, is that it's not just about blending, it's about upsetting the apple cart and giving folks a little bit more voting power than others. So thank you.
Moving on, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and as Commissioner Gerlach, and I don't disagree with a lot of your diagnosis here, and I have Representative Albright's more or less your bill from last year coming up later. I've for several terms, including this term, have advocated for direct election of the Metropolitan Council. And I was wondering what you would think of that as an option.
Commissioner Gerlach.
Well, Madam Chair, and President Forrest, again, it's off, real off track of this. It's not what's being proposed here. And,
right.
And but direct election does two things. There's good and bad with any proposal. The good from something like that is it does certainly solve the representation issue, but the downside, of course, is you create a whole other layer of government, and as we all know, there's a lot more muscles get flexed and laws get passed and budgets get increased, and it's certainly of my opinion that if you did a direct election of a Met Council, you would see an entity that would grow by 2-3 times the size, and it would just be its own, because it would have its own mini sovereignty, so to speak, without much oversight, because you would put the wheels in motion, so that the downside of a directly elected Met Council far outweighs the benefit. The bill we're proposing is a middle ground. It's a compromise between that. It takes, you know, gets that democracy piece in there, but not the downside.
Okay, one follow-up question. Then I'm kind of glad you talked about growing government, because you know, this bill grows at by 37%. You're increasing membership from 17 to 27 members. I guess, you know, to the author, why are you increasing the size of the council so dramatically?
Representative Albright.
Representative Hornstein, you and I have shared eggs over breakfast talking about this very subject.
Yeah.
So it seems like we're going back to that. This is not about the issue of growing government. This is about growing the opportunity for citizens to have representation on a council that for the last 50 years has gone unaccounted. If you take a look at the history of the Met Council, and I remarked earlier today that my father-in-law was one of the co-authors on the bill that established the Met Council, and when he and I had a conversation about that, he apologized for what I'm now trying to rectify, because at its very core, it was about regional planning. It was about regional development, but it was not about enforcement of mandates, It was not about the enforcement of experiments and or another agenda on municipalities, other than at its core it was intended for wastewater treatment and sewer functions and the guidance of making sure that there was a coordinated effort between the municipalities and the metro area. I will add to this that just in the recent number of weeks, we now understand that there has been an addition. Congratulations, Representative McDonald, because now parts of Wright and Sherburne County are included in the MPO. And that was without the decision and or the voice of those folks being heard. And so it is in direct confrontation and conflict with what our representative republic is all about.
All right. Thank you. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Gerlach or Representative Albright, we had mentioned the disconnect between the cities and the Met Council and their operations, and certainly in Lakeville. I hear that from my city council, but also around the region. But to this bill, the Met Council, some of the other disconnect is some of the other programs and policies that are implemented that may be, to Commissioner Gerlach, are there functions that are better served at a local level, the county level, maybe a city level, that may provide more responsiveness to constituent needs? And are those addressed in this bill?
Commissioner Gerlach.
Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick, that goes far from the actual bill, because we made a conscious decision that the governance structure was the first piece to go after, to rectify, and then from that a thorough evaluation of scope of operations and all of that could take place thereafter. So we've taken great pains not to go after any specific complaints. We didn't want a long litany of those sorts of things, because that will, once people have had their say, a lot of those can be rectified. But I'm not in a position to list out those things. At this point, we're not going after the scope of responsibilities with this bill.
Right. Thank you. I appreciate the bill coming forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Albright, for pursuing all stakeholders and keeping it a bipartisan effort. I mean, you've got my senator, Senator Newton, to sign on to the Senate file, and I appreciate that. And one thing I want to say is this is a bipartisan problem, so we need a bipartisan solution. Plenty opposed all sorts of Met Council reforms when he was governor, and now we have a new governor that's opposing our reforms when we're coming through here. So we do need to work with everybody in the group to actually get something done. And the reason why we have all this bevy of Met Council bills today is because people don't feel like they're being heard. They have no recourse to what the council does. So now our only alternative is to change the governance of the council, because it's only appointed by one man. And I think this is a great bill, and it's bipartisan. And if we can make it better to get broader support and get the governor signing, I'd be incredibly pleased.
Okay, thank you. Are there any further questions or discussion on the bill? Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've heard quite a bit of testimony today on the unprecedented expansion of government with regards to this bill. We've heard about how the appointments do not weigh population, lending certain powers to certain members. But I wanted to focus, get back to the inherent conflict of interest as part of the appointing of local officials. And I guess this would be for the author. Section 1.29 states, the local elected officials identified in paragraph A are compatible with the office of the Metropolitan Council members. If I can get some clarification on what was meant by the term compatible.
Representative or Commissioner?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative Carlson, I can tell you exactly what that's all about.
Please.
There is a statute that specifically lays out incompatibility of offices, which prohibits people from being elected to different offices at the same time. There are exceptions to that, and there are some that are incompatible, some that are not. And we had an opinion, we asked somebody for an opinion on that, and the opinion came back was that as we were proposing this, that it is not explicitly precluded by the incompatibility of offices statute. However, that question is going to come up, and it would behoove us that if we drafted a bill, that we should put a specific clarification on that topic to make sure that everybody would know that it's not incompatible. So when we have the bill drafted, we specifically have that provision added to make that clear.
Representative Carlson. Any follow-up?
That was a very fast explanation. So can you reference again, please, the statute which you were referring to in with regards to compatibility?
Sure. I think Jeff Dyson probably did.
Do we have some
I'm sure that we can get back to the representative with that after the meeting.
Okay. And I guess follow-up question, would that be, thank you, Madam Chair, that would be something you consider as part of an amendment to the current legislation?
Commissioner Gerlach, or the
for the definer, for the very reason.
It's, Madam Chair, that provision is in the bill for the specific purpose of clarification of that. Should that question arise on incompatibility of offices, this law, should it pass, would explicitly say that it is not incompatible for local elected officials to serve in a capacity on the Met Council.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on that question, is there a basis for you putting, did you just put that statement in to cover it, or is there background on that?
Commissioner Gerlach.
Madam Chair, again, Representative Mason, the question does come up, and it has come up over the last couple of years in various discussions, what about the incompatibility of office statute? And so that is the background as to then, well, for drafting a bill, let's make it clear that it's not incompatible. So that is, that's why it's explicitly put in the bill, to make it compatible.
Okay. Representative Carlson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. But it's not. If it was to be explicit, wouldn't we cite that statute to which you were referring to?
Commissioner Gerlach.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I would refer to Deb Dyson on how that is. We had the idea. I mean, we want to make sure the idea was in the bill. She drafted me. She knows best how to do that.
Dyson, can you help us out?
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I don't know if there's a specific statute that on incompatible, but often enough the legislature will put into statute when offices that would under case law otherwise be analyzed as incompatible, we'll just say the legislature has deemed this to be compatible because we want these two to be eligible together. But and there are other statutes that where and some cases where they just say these are compatible. So this statement is to sort of preempt the argument that the offices are potentially incompatible. But so it's, in terms of there being a specific statute that lays out what's incompatible, that I don't recall, but there are cases that talk about what is compatible and incompatible.
Thank you.
Representative Ibrahim, did I see your hand?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this is for Ms. Dyson, and maybe we need to, so it's your statutes, you put it in so that it makes it compatible. So by saying it's compatible, it's compatible. But I'm sure there's been lawsuits on different areas on that too. But is there something that, is there anything in statute that prohibits, I know it prohibits people from being elected to two different bodies at one time. Is there anything that prohibits somebody from being given a salary for two different, for being on two different bodies at one time? Because I guess that's the part where I'm even more concerned. It's not just a city council person serving here, but on Met Council. But when I was on city council, we got paid a whopping $4,000 a year. Let's say I decide to take this opportunity to be appointed to the Met Council as well, and now they're paying me $20,000 a year. So, you know, that questions loyalty as well when it comes to cash.
Ms. Dyson, any follow-up there?
Madam Chair and Representative Joachim, the bill states that the $20,000 is in addition to any compensation. That's in the language of the bill. So that's been addressed in the bill.
Okay. Representative, follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand that it's been addressed in the bill and put in the bill. My comment, though, is that somebody, not only should they not be elected to two different bodies, and I know you get around that by saying appointed, but now you're being paid by two different bodies, and that hope it opens up a whole other ball of wax. So thank you.
Okay. We have a Representative Kosdick question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll try to respect the time. I know we're pushing it, but we have a lot of questions. And either to the author or maybe Commissioner Gerlach, are there other regional planning type planning organizations in the state of Minnesota?
Commissioner or
Madam Chair and Representative Kosnick, yes, there are a whole host running the gamut from Bemidji to St. Cloud to Duluth to Mankato to Rochester to Fargo to La Crosse, Mankato, and in every instance, and I'm certainly happy to provide this to you, but they all, the majority of the voting members are locally elected officials.
Okay, that was my, Madam Chair, excuse me.
Representative,
thank you, Representative Albright. That was my point, is that, just to clarify, we have other regional planning organizations in Minnesota, and they do, in fact, have elected officials serving on their boards, except for the Metropolitan Council.
Madam Chair and Representative Kozak, that is a correct statement.
Okay, thank you. And, you know, I just want to reiterate, Madam Chair, that, you know, what I think you're doing with this bill is trying to make it more accountable and a better serving body. And for that, I appreciate you bringing the bill forward.
Okay. And seeing no further discussion on the bill, I will renew my motion that House File 828 be laid over as amended for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative. All right. Next up is House File 1150, Representative Uglum. We have... And, Representative, I will go ahead and move that... House File 1150 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And thanks very much for bringing the bill. And give us, please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, and now that we've got everybody's attention, I do have an oral amendment that I'd like to add to the bill.
And let's hear your oral amendment, Representative.
Well, really quite simple, Madam Chair. On 1.12, I would like to change 80 to 60%.
All right. And I'll move the oral amendment for you, Representative, and know that it needs any explanation or any qualifications. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be before this august committee here. I want to call your attention to the fact that this is a policy bill, and it has policy and objectives into it, and basically it's quite simple when we talk about how much we're going to do as far as fare box recovery. The objective of 60% is the objective is 60% fare box recovery by 2022 for the affected entities. This is an objective for the first fare box recovery since 2008. This would be moving forward and upward in terms of the cost of fare box. Fact is, now, as you know, and probably many of you have, for instance, you can ride light rail in downtown Minneapolis or St. Paul for 50 cents. And that, to me, seems to be ridiculously cheap. The point is, too, with a 60% number, and one reason I picked that is this can be done right now. The 35W Express bus, for instance, is returning 71% fare box recovery. Maple Grove is at about 53%. And the Southwest Light Rail, one of our favorite subjects, is projected to be at 41%. So we're within the realm here, particularly by pushing this out till 2022. It's important to understand, too, that the average person that gets on the train or the average person that gets on a bus and they pay their fare, they think they're paying the whole thing. They think that that's the cost. But obviously it's not. And if you add up the figures on some of the handouts that I provided, we're paying $250 million in subsidies, the taxpayers are, $250 million. So my objective on this bill is to get something a little bit closer to drive down these costs of $250 million for the taxpayers and to be a little more responsible in terms of collecting the fares that reflect a real cost. So that, in essence, is the bill, Madam Chair, and I do have a testifier.
All right, thank you. So why don't you please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, I'm Kim Crockett with Center of the American Experiment. The language in House File 1150 sets an aspirational goal, as the representative noted. It's not unlike when Minnesota set a zero deaths goal for our highways. While not perfect, it actually worked rather well. Ideally, all services would cover about 100% of their operating costs, though that's not a reasonable goal today. I can't tell you what the ideal farebox recovery rate should be, but as noted, it should be within sort of driving range, if you will, of where transit systems are hitting today, in that 50 to 60% range, though recognizing this would require a whole new business model for bus and light rail transit in Minnesota. Our light rail system right now is young compared to other parts of the country. We have a lot of experience in running bus services, and that means that we can learn from the mistakes that other states have made and are making and be a leader and improve on the model. Transit all over the country is in disrepair. States are still building new systems for light rail, for example, without having learned the lesson that you cannot really afford something if you do not pay the capital cost, the operating cost, and capital repair or capital replacement costs, and build that into your budget. The American Society of Civil Engineers has estimated that our nation is $3.6 trillion behind in infrastructure repair costs and replacement costs. And as one commentator recently put it, this is a form of borrowing. More cash is available in the current period, but a future obligation in the same amount plus accrued costs is created, and this is just like a loan. And who are we passing the cost of that loan on to? We are passing them on to our children and our grandchildren. Minnesota has already built out some light rail and is planning other systems right now. What all these trains, for example, have in common is that operating and maintenance costs have not been built into state and local budgets. And so whether the money comes from a higher farebox recovery rate or other revenue sources should be a matter of very clear policy and planning, because the consequences of buy now and pay later are causing financial and safety concerns all over the country. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Crockett. We do have several folks from the audience. Mr. McDonald, Jerry McDonald, is he available? Wish to testify? Please come forward. Okay, we have Luther Winder. Is he available? All right.
Madam Chair.
Jim Merkel. Yes.
There's one thing that I overlooked in my opening remarks, and that is, and I believe it's in your packets, this fare recovery would not apply to Metro Mobility in terms of the bill before us today.
Sure. Thank you for that clarification.
Yep.
So, yes, please, welcome to the committee, and sir, please give us your name for the record and do present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Good afternoon. My name is Jerry McDonald. I am the chair of the Suburban Transit Association, and I'm also a councilman at the Chanhassen City Council. The STA is an association of four transit providers: Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, Southwest Transit, Plymouth Metro Link, and Maple Grove Transit. We also serve the cities of Eagan, Apple Valley, Burnsville, Shakopee, Eden Prairie, Chanhassen, Chaska, Carver, Plymouth, and Maple Grove. In 2016, the members of the STA provided over 5.5 million trips to the residents of this region. We are here today to ask that the farebox recovery bill before you be given extreme and careful and thoughtful consideration as you take testimony and consider its enactment. You must be mindful of the unintended consequences that could result as we, the transit providers, also comply with federal law relating to Title VI and the ADA. While we as the suburban transit providers support efforts to become more efficient in our operations, we ask that you are mindful that one of the unintended consequences could be to limit the very people who depend the most on public transit to get to their jobs and also to medical appointments without other means to do so. Other thoughtful considerations that should be given to subsidies for transportation are benefits for congestion relief in the metropolitan highway system, public safety in terms of support that transit gives to public safety during times of emergencies and national disasters, and the environmental benefits of removing vehicles from the highways. I would like to now introduce Mr. Luther Winder, who is the executive director of the Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, and he will share with you his experience in Maryland when the Maryland legislature also passed a similar bill requiring only a 35% recovery rate. Thank you for your time.
Good afternoon, sir. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Luther Winder, executive director of Minnesota Valley Transit Authority. Across the country, other states have implemented legislation to mandate fare recovery ratios to varying degrees of success. Through my knowledge, none have implemented, say, a 60 to 80% fare recovery ratio, but I do want to state the current average fare recovery of MVTA, Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, which I'm executive director of, is about 23%. My personal experiences with one state that neighbored my previous transit agency in Delaware was MTA in Baltimore. Maryland is one of the few states that legally requires a transit authority to cover a certain percentage of operating costs from fare recovery. And their ratio right now is 35%. While California legally requires a certain percentage for transit, their percentage significantly less, about 10%. In the urban area, it's 20% based on California legislation. The fare box recovery rate created a strong, in Maryland, disincentive for investing in transit, including maintenance, cleaning, and training operators. Because every investment that increases the operating cost of a vehicle makes it harder to meet said fare recovery ratio goals. As an example, one would say that if you needed to replace, say, your windshield wipers or your bus, you need to fix the brakes, you need to clean the bus, say more than say once a week or twice or twice a month, or you want to do some retraining for operators, that would increase obviously your operating costs for that particular system. Those basic investments sometimes, based on when you mandate a fare recovery ratio, are what we utilized in a way to meet that goal, which is we would minimize those type of investments. And we necessarily don't want to jeopardize the safety of our vehicles, as well as our cleanliness and the overall impression of operating public. But for the most important, as a regional provider, part of the regional fare system under the Metropolitan Council, one of my concerns is that mandating fare recovery ratios may lead to a substantial increase in fares and reduction in bus services. A substantial increase in transit fares to meet mandated fare recovery ratios may hit struggling communities the hardest, as well as impact our commuter riders. All suburban transit providers are committed to continuing to work with the legislator as needed to find innovative and metric-based ways to improve transit within the region. So we're not saying that there does not need to be metric-based or fare recovery ratios. We just want to continue that discussion, obviously, with you in order to help assist in that discussion. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I just want to reiterate that this is a policy bill. We are not mandating 60% fare recovery rates. This is only a guideline. Thank you.
Thank you. And next up, Jim Urkel, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. Welcome to the committee, sir. And
thank you.
Please give us your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Urkel. I'm an attorney with Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and I direct MCA's Land Use and Transportation Program, and I'm fighting a cold, so I apologize. I thank you for the opportunity to speak this afternoon, and I want to make three quick points in opposition to House File 1150. First, fare box recovery is one of a number of efficiency and effectiveness measures that transit agencies use to assess their character and breadth of their operations. It's a mistake to make fare box recovery a primary objective of planning for the region's public transportation. I think you heard that from the suburban providers. I know of only three similar requirements around the country. California requires 20% fare box recovery in order to get funding through their Transit Development Act. Colorado, Denver RTD has a 30% fare recovery requirement. And the state of Maryland has a 35% right now. It started at 50%. Nobody could meet it. It went down to 40. Nobody could meet it. It's at 35, and almost all of the, like the Maryland Transportation Administration is coming in at about 30% right now. So the problem is the number. Even if you want to set it as a standard, requiring 80% would be wildly unrealistic. 60% is somewhat unrealistic. Federal Transit Administration's National Transit Database just released its 2015 data for the top 50 transit agencies in the U.S. And one of the things that should have been passed around is a list. On the front page is the longer list shows Metro Transit fares against a number of regional peers. There are nine peers, four from blue states, four from red, and one from sort of purplish Colorado. What you can see is that Metro Transit and its numbers basically fall smack dab in the middle of all of the peers. And you don't really see too many 50% or 60%, certainly not 80% out there. You heard earlier today a reference to the Legislative Auditor's report in 2011 on transit governance in the Twin Cities region. They used the National Transit Database numbers in making their comparisons as well. They also, and these numbers are like 7 years more up to date than those now, but they basically show the same kinds of things. They use the numbers not just for regional peers, but also looking at all providers in the Seven County Metro. So they looked at the suburban providers as well. I've taken those numbers. 2015 was the first year that I know of that the suburban providers actually made it into the National Transit Database. So these are fairly new, and you can see the kinds of numbers that play out. And the city of Maple Grove is reporting a fare box recovery ratio of 53.7%, but that's not on the express routes that they run. Those are actually run by contract through Metro Transit. These numbers, including the rather whopping $310.90 per passenger trip, are based on their more local operations. So you can see, you know, how Metro Transit ranks out, both on in terms of bus service as well as in terms of how it operates in this region. You can see how light rail plays out both here as well as its peer regions. So basically, my last point is that if it's good for Metro Transit, it should be good for all providers of transit, the suburban providers as well. And you should be looking at the transit agencies in greater Minnesota. I looked at preliminary numbers that came out, have been coming out through the Minnesota Department of Transportation on their planning efforts for transit in greater Minnesota, and their numbers are on the order of 15% to 20%. If it's good enough for Metro Transit, it should be applied across the board uniformly as an effectiveness measure for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Hornstein, a question?
Yes, thank you. This is for Mr. Urkel. So you had pointed out the operating expenses per passenger trip. Is that the same, or is it a different number when we talk about the operating subsidy? Because then I think we're focusing on fare box recovery, but there's also a subsidy per passenger. Is that correct?
Right, and you can back into that. Excuse me, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein. You can get to the other number that the legislative auditor used was subsidy per passenger.
Right.
And basically that's taking operating costs, netting out the fare box recovery, and applying it to the unlinked passenger trips, assuming that those are each one is a passenger. You can get to that off of my chart by just taking the operating expenses per passenger trip and reducing it by the fare box recovery, so 23.6%. Do that to the 477 for Metro Transit, you'll get the subsidy per passenger trip, and the same down the line.
So,
I'm not going to be able to do the math very quickly, but I'm not opposed to subsidies for opt-outs or transit in general, but could you give us approximate figure for the difference between the per-passenger subsidy between Metro Transit and some of these other providers?
Mr. Urkel?
Madam Chair, I think you'll find that the subsidy per passenger will be lower for Metro Transit than any of the other numbers, just given the numbers that are here. I mean, I'm happy to crank them separately. I didn't have time to do them over the weekend, but I'm happy to provide them to the committee.
We'd invite you to do that. It'd be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Iwakim.
These are such lovely mics. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the question would go to the author. Representative Uglem, is there a reason why you left Greater Minnesota Transit out of the equation for fare box recovery?
Representative Uglem.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Joachim. This is a start, okay? and again, a policy guideline. And policies are designed to be looked at, tracked, followed, changed, or whatever. So that's the reason I believe that we want to study the Metro here first and see what we can do in terms of moving towards increased fare box recovery and moving towards lessening the $250 million burden on the taxpayer. And if it does work, then I think you're right. We should do that.
So good.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Uglem. I agree that goals are laudable, and I just think that 60%, I don't think that goal or that mark has been hit anywhere else in the country, but hey, reach for it, and it's nice to know that out of all the modes, light rail is the closest to reaching that goal. But I just worry about that being the primary objective, which is what a few other folks had mentioned. And if I can recall, last week we had a testifier in that said the fare box recovery for the St. Cloud transit system was only 15%. So maybe they have some work to do, too. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My questions have been being answered. And Representative Uglem, have you had a chance to look at how this recovery rate relates to the use of our highways? Do you know what percentage we are at with the subsidy of people driving on our roadways, like, well, through property taxes and those sorts of things? Have you had a chance to compare that?
Representative Bernardi. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bernardi. No, because that's not within the scope of this bill. I have not done that. That perhaps might be another bill someday.
All right. Is there anyone else from the audience who wishes to make a few brief comments? Please come forward, sir. Good afternoon, sir. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Charles Grace. I'm a minnow compared to everyone else here. I'm a private citizen. I'm not involved in as a transit consultant or expert or someone employed in that sector. But I do have an interest in HF 1150. It seeks, among other points, to establish this fare box recovery ratio for routes operated by the Met Council. By the way, data in Wikipedia, it's 4 or 5 years old, says that Met Transit's ratio right now is 34%. There are three ways to boost the revenue side of that ratio. It's boost ridership, raise fares, or improve fare compliance. And that's my testimony today deals with this minnow item of improving fare compliance. Met Council has looked at turnstile models, for example, and has dismissed them as not cost effective. They haven't worked it when Los Angeles had added them, and they don't appreciably add, the turnstile model doesn't really add a lot to other cities that have tried that without it. But there are other options that the Met Council has not considered. In 2014, my travels take me a lot to Europe, and in 2014, I saw that Amsterdam's GVB fare compliance system on their trams has become very sophisticated. So I made a mental note and later wrote then-Representative Runbeck, Madam Chair, and you have a copy of that. The cleverness of the Amsterdam system is they employ four tactics that have nearly eliminated fare jumping. The tactics are listed on the document that I passed along to the committee. They use plastic passes and paper tickets with an embedded RFID chip, sold at stations, hotels, and the normal way to do this. The ticket is swiped past scanners when one enters and, when, importantly, when one leaves the car. The process freezes the ticket on board so it can't be used or handed to a friend to use, and your exit scan unfreezes the ticket. I suspect that since 2014, scanners have now been retrofitted for mobile devices. I mean, that's given how technology-oriented the Dutch are, I would expect that that's occurring. Step number two, all cars have onboard scanners. So when you go into a tram, there's an in-and-out scanner like the one shown in the picture that I provided to the committee. You pass a valid ticket in front of the scanner and you get a ding. If you pass an invalid ticket or walk past it without scanning, there is an embarrassing buzz, so everybody in the car knows you're a fare jumper. Brilliant, low cost, the onboard security camera also snaps a frame of the fare jumper. They also have retrofitted onboard gates onto their cars. It's the next level of compliance. Not all cars, but some cars. Retrofitted, the gates stay rigid until a ticket is properly scanned across it, and then they open up. One never knows what car they're going to get. So there is significant compliance. And when combined with a scanner, it appears to thwart both fare jumpers and the unprepared tourists like me. It also, a rider again must scan to pass to leave. So you can't leave until you scan the gate or scan your ticket. The gate opens up and then you can leave. That's actually very important if a city ever decides to go to multiple fares where a longer distance gets a larger fare. That technology is what's being used, entrance and exit scan. They also, as a fourth measure, on their tourists and randomly on other routes, throw train cars that have a middle door ticket booth, like the one I showed in the picture. The agent gets a small slice of the sales, so they're motivated to ensure compliance, sell day or multiple passes to tourists, and call out fare jumpers. They're trained in security and are also well informed in how to get around the city. So just to wrap up, the beauty of the system in Amsterdam is you never know the level of security if you're a fare jumper that you're going to be presented with at the car, whether it's a scanner, the gate, or the ticket taker. Amsterdam locals take pride in that their compliance is very high. It's one example. I've ridden in other European cities that have similar setups that result in very high compliance. I support 1150, particularly now that the goal has been reduced to recovery ratio of 60%. And I would like to see, I think it will force Metro Transit to look beyond the traditional American turnstile and look for other innovative approaches that are being used around the country.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else then that wishes to make very brief comments? We're quickly running out of time. So, and Mr. Grace, if you would please resend the handout that you had provided us.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you.
Hi,
good afternoon. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Yeah, Bobby Ginn Kearney, Jr., Minneapolis, a registered lobbyist for We the People. I'm sorry that it's so late in the testimony. I do want to make a brief comment, and more generally about all the bills that are coming out here. There's obviously an effort to try to get transit spending under control. And when the Met Council presented to this committee, they had a slide showing from the years 2015 to 2040, planning on spending $31+ billion in the metro area. On roads and bridges, it's $50 billion for all sources. And I actually think that's leaving out some federal money, but let's not quibble. It's 3.8% of all the trips. It's 37% of all the money. So there's a huge problem here, and I'm very sympathetic to everybody that's trying to get a handle on this. But let me suggest that a partial solution is no solution. This is too narrow a focus. We need to have a more general study of transit alternatives, including buses and automated driving. But more than anything, we need to take a look at the fact we cannot continue with the current trajectory that we're on, we owe it to we the people in Minnesota to start thinking about how we're going to deal with this revolution that's going on in automated driving. We have a tremendous opportunity here. And so I want to just urge not to have such a narrow focus on this particular goal. We need to have a much broader study of our opportunities.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we have one more testifier.
Two.
Three. Well, can we ask you to please keep it to very, very brief?
Good afternoon, House
Good
Chair.
Good afternoon. Please introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Harry Maddox, Transportation Board Equity Committee. Brief comments are this bill I'm opposed to 1150 is because it's specific to the metro area, and as an equity committee member, it seems like the implications are more racial and metro bias versus statewide, and I don't think that's right. And also, as a rider of Metro Transit, I feel like it's going to drive riders away, it's going to put more cars on the road, and it's also not environmentally friendly. If we're moving towards moving Minnesota, we should look towards enhancing transit, not just making lousy bills to kind of kill it or suppress it or look for other funds. There are other ways they should be able to find them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone we haven't heard from? If you could limit your testimony to just a few brief comments, that would be all we can handle at this point. We have to take up another bill. So, welcome, sir. Give us your name for the record.
Madam Chair, Scott Halstead from Sunny Shoreview, Minnesota. I speak in support of the bill. We need more efficient transit. That can drive the prices down. We have far too much cost. We have 9 minutes to go through downtown Minneapolis, 1 mile. You got to get more efficient. You need to elevate under tunnel, whatever, but you need to drive the costs down. And until we do that, get more efficient, fare recovery is going to be very difficult. So 45 or 47-minute trips from downtown St. Paul to downtown Minneapolis, on time record, 82%, 18% are not on time. So you need to be on time, be on schedule, get to places quickly. And until you do that, you're going to have big costs.
Very good. Thank you, sir, for your testimony. We have a couple. Well, let's just see if we can't get through the testimony, please, if we can. So do you have a few brief comments, Mr. Shettenden?
Yeah, I have a few comments. I don't care. Members, Judd Shettenden with the Metropolitan Council. I'll be brief. I do think that the comments from our partners from the suburban transit providers did a good job of kind of outlining some of the concerns we have with the bill. I just want members to realize that when we do talk about increasing fares, that there is some elasticity between what you lose in ridership when you raise fares to a particular point. And I did talk to Representative Uglum prior to the committee, and I know that I spoke to this committee sometime in the last few weeks. It seems like I'm here a lot, but the council is in the process of actually beginning the process of looking at raising fares. Okay. And so you'll be seeing a letter, an email from Chair Dunnick in the next couple days outlining that. But I know that what Representative Uglum here is doing is trying to make a point, and we take fares very, very serious as well, but there are a lot of considerations that you have to take into consideration when you do this, because different types of services have different types of fare recovery, and oftentimes when we do raise fares, it's those people who have the least ability to pay that it hits the most, those people that are cash-carrying customers. And so all of that, when we talk about fares, in Madam Chair, I understand this is important to say.
We are going to reconvene tonight, though, 50 minutes after session, and
Madam Chair,
perhaps you'll be here.
That sounds good. I'll be here for this and the other bills. It's just very important to think about the impact of who ends up paying that fare, because the CAS customer oftentimes is the person who can't afford that 31-day pass or isn't getting a Metro pass from their business who's subsidizing that. So it's just very, very important to think about when we are raising fares, how we do it. I'm going to take Representative Uglum, our conversation serious, and we'll have that conversation, but I just wanted to mention to the committee that we are kicking off that process of looking at raising fares, and you'll be hearing from Chair Dunick in the next 24 to 48 okay. hours about that.
Super. So, thank you very much, Mr. Shetnan.
Yep.
And is this on the bill, Mr. Qualley? 2 minutes? 1 minute? 30 seconds? We are going to take up the Nash bill, House File 600. So very quickly, please.
Madam Chair, good morning. Thank you very much, committee members. Philip Qualley, United Transportation Union, Smart TD, just thank you for 30 seconds. We do not represent workers that operate the light rail and transit, but I would like to simply say that when we look at the expenses, please be reminded respectfully that what you pay the workers that are doing the vital service being provided, we do put our monies back into the Main Street economy and support all of our regional economies. Thank you very much.
Oh, great, thank you. And I'll have your question here, but let's have Representative Nash begin to make his way forward.
It's a comment, and I can wait about this bill, but if you want me to wait till the evening or later this afternoon, I can do that.
I'd appreciate that, Representative. That would be great. Seeing no further comments at this point, I'm going to go ahead and renew my motion that House File 1150, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative
Uglum. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
And we're going to move to Representative Nash so that he doesn't have to show up tonight. Thank you, Representative. And I'm going to move your house file 600 and lay it over for possible inclusion in the
Madam Chair, it's actually House File 800.
That's what I thought, and I'm seeing this. It's 800. Yes, sorry. So House File 800 laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. We're glad to be here in transportation again. House File 800 is a very straightforward, simple bill, and it's along the lines of if we didn't build it, we shouldn't pay to maintain it or operate it. That's kind of the crux of things. And it relates particularly to some of the more recent light rail projects that you've seen. And as we all know, most of us lived through the fact that the state did not appropriate money for it and that the Southwest Light Rail is being appropriated in a different manner. So the story that I have to share to kind of add a little bit of context to this is I had a neighbor who built a fence around their home, and they set it back so that the fence was not on my property at all. And I asked them why they did this, and they said, well, Jim, because we realized that you didn't want the fence, and being a good neighbor, we're not going to put it anywhere near your property so that you don't actually have to help pay for the maintenance of it. So it was a wooden fence, and I told them I was opposed to it. So being a good neighbor, they did it so that I didn't have any play in it. I didn't help build it. I didn't help pay for it. And they realized that I shouldn't help maintain it long term. That's the crux of this bill. And it says that if a light rail project is built using other than state appropriated funds or funds that go through the state, that we shouldn't be on the hook to do OPEX or maintenance. So very straightforward bill, Madam Chair, and I would be happy to stand for questions.
Okay. Are there any questions from the members? Okay, Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know you have a timeline, you're rushing through these bills, but a lot of them are really important, and I think there may be, I don't know if there's folks in the audience to testify on this bill, or did you want questions first?
I'll take either. Anyone in the audience care to testify to the bill?
Okay. Madam Chair. While I'm not thrilled about returning after session because I had ambitions of going home, if you deem it necessary and testifiers would like to come back, I'll stay if necessary.
Okay. We might wish you to do that, so we'll take your bill up first. Unless there is, we maybe get the comments on the record, could that be done in a minute or two?
I know Mr. Shetnan speaks quickly, but I'm not sure a minute is going to do the job.
Well, I think we're probably going to have to
it's regrettable, but
close
it's
it down
fine.
Here.
It's fine.
All right.
I'm happy to come back.
Thank you very much, Representative. And we will resume at 15 minutes after. after or the after session or at the call of the chair right here in this basement hearing room. So keep all of your papers, keep them in your folders, folks, and we will recess. Thank you very much. Members, the meeting will come to order. We'll resume, that is. We have Representative Nash on the stand here with House File 600 or 800, apologize, and I'm going to amend my motion and move Representative Nash's House File 600 to Transportation Finance Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate amending that motion. I was approached on the floor by Chair Torkelson, as I'm sure you were as well, who noted that there are fiscal implications, so we're going to send it there as soon as we're done here. You know, before we broke to go to the floor, I was all done, and I think Mr. Shetman was going to testify. I think from there we can pursue expediency and move you all along your way. I think I saw a large stack of other bills you're going to be dealing with.
Very good. Thank you, Representative. And
you love this bill.
From Mr. Shetman.
Yeah.
That's what I heard.
He was getting all
warmed
up before, so.
Great. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members. Again, I'm Judd Shetman with the Met Council. And regarding House File 800, this bill is a the council has some concerns about it relating to how it will affect our approach to the Southwest LRT and the Bottineau LRT lines. The way that this bill reads, it says that a bill has to be in revenue operations in order for the state to be paying the 50% share. And when we have gone through the process of preparing the Southwest line, we've been using current state statute that says the state will pay 50% of the operating costs for these lines as we move forward. And so with what we have brought forward to our federal partners, how we work things out with our with CTIV and Hennepin County partners on this, that if this bill moves forward, we don't have a way to pay for the state share of the operating costs of that line. And so that is a concern for us. What the governor has proposed and what the council has proposed in the past is to have this funded through a regional sales tax, which would be an alternative way to not have the state pay for this. But the way that this bill sits right now, it creates an issue for us as far as keeping up our end of the bargain with how we have provided, and bless you, Mr. Burris, with how we will be bringing forward the package that we brought forward to the our federal partners and local partners on the operating side. So with that, we would oppose the bill as stands.
All right, thank you. Are there questions or other folks that wish to testify? Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nash, the way I'm understanding this, you're treating certain projects differently than others. Is that a correct assumption on the way this bill is put together?
Representative Nash.
Madam Chair and Representative Mason, what we're dealing with is it's essentially the Southwest project that was not appropriated through state funds, and we're just saying that if it wasn't paid for with state funds moving forward, we're not going to be paying for maintenance and operations.
Representative Mason, follow up?
Yes. I think I've made it pretty clear that I'm very frustrated with the fact that we're not getting enough funding to get a lot of projects done. And the way I'm interpreting this is you are putting us way backwards. Instead of trying to get Minnesota forward, you're already stopping something that has been funded rather than concentrating on getting us on projects that we haven't even started on. I just have a real hard time understanding why you're trying to do this to Minnesota when we're way, way behind where we should be.
Right. Hey, Madam Chair.
And Mr. Shetman.
To the comment that the author made just a minute ago, I would suggest that the state has participated and put money toward the Southwest line. Going back to 2009, 2011, 2013, the state has brought funds forward toward this project. So if you look at how the bill reads, it says that the state has to provide an appropriation from state sources or specifies lateral transit portion or project is for a portion of the project capital cost. that threshold was met and those funds were provided back in 2009, 2011, and 2013.
Can you refresh our memory on, do you know the total that the state, I know that we repealed or
yep, Madam
rescinded
Chair, I can run that through
about
for the
30
committee
million.
For you. Back in 2009, there was a general obligation bonding bill that passed that provided $5 million towards Southwest. In 2011, there were $2 million of general obligation bonds that were provided to the Southwest Corridor. In 2013, there was $37 million of general fund that was provided to the project. In 2015, the legislature canceled $30 million. There was $29.7 million of that. However, it provided that money back to the council for the vast majority of it. So the council just basically put that money right back into the project. So to this date, there's been about $37 million total provided to that project.
Okay. All right.
From state dollars.
All right. Are there other questions or discussion? Mr. Carney? Oh, I'm sorry. Joaquim?
Thank you, Chair. I just was going to clarify what Representative Nash said, but Mr. Shetland did that quite well. Thank you.
All right. And I think we've got our number, I think, Mr. Carney, so maybe we're good.
I just want to make a real brief comment on that.
Please give your name for the record.
Yeah, Bobbigan Carney, Jr., Minneapolis, registered lobbyist for We the People. When the legislature canceled the $30 million, roughly, of that appropriation for Southwest in 2015, they appropriated the money to operating expenses for the Metro Council. And Mr. Shetland said that it was appropriated back to the Metro Council. That is not quite accurate. And I'm very concerned about the accounting that occurred subsequent to that, because I do believe that some of that money did find its way back to Southwest, and it was very specifically appropriated for operating. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the clarification. All right. Seeing no, we have another Joaquim.
Oh, sorry, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make final comments on the bill. Is that
please go ahead. Sure.
All right. Representative Nash, I'm really having a hard time with this, and you and I can take this conversation offline. This is specifically drafted not only to kill Southwest Light Rail and future plans in Botno, but it really affects the East Metro and any future plans that we might be having to expand transit into that area as well. And just curious, actually, I guess I do have a question. Why didn't you not include BRT?
Why didn't I not?
Yes.
I mean, why did
That's
I not?
That's a double negative. Sorry about that.
Representative.
Sorry to be the grammar police there. But your question was again?
Why not BRT included in this?
Representative Nash.
No, Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative, I chose to focus on this particular project because it was a very recent occurrence. And it does deal with some other issues of expanding lines and so on. But this was a very timely thing brought to me by many of my constituents who said, you know, this is something that we've seen. You know, the legislature did not appropriate money. It was seen as an end around by the certificates of participation, and therefore the folks who literally filled up a listening session of mine said, you know, we don't feel that if we didn't pay to build it that we should be paying to maintain it and continue the operation. So, you know, this was a direct input from my constituency, and you had the same sort of inputs from yours, so I'm trying to represent them well.
Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and yes, you're right. I do have a lot of direct input from my constituency and work on this line for over 12 years, and not just hundreds of people, but thousands of people that have filled listening sessions and planning sessions, and this was driven by local control. So I'm having a tough time with it, obviously. And I wanted to correct again, I think Mr. Shetner did correct very well, that there has been state money appropriated for this project. So thank you.
Representative Nash, any final words?
Thank you all.
Okay. And I will renew my motion that House File 800 be re-referred to the Transportation Committee. And we will take a vote on that. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Representative. We're going to do 14. And we will take up my bill now, so I'd like to have Representative Kosnick please take the gavel.
I'm so sorry, Chair. I didn't know if you were going to be stuck up there for a while, but since this came up and moving jurisdiction with this bill, with 800, Representative Albright's bill, by our own House Rules 4.13, Section C, should be going to GovOps and Elections. So are the bills that you're looking at laying over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, will that pull the whole omnibus bill then to GovOps? Is that the intention?
Representative, I believe that's where we would go with it, yes. So we'll reconvene and meet on and take a vote on that.
And then would that whole bill then move on to government operations?
Correct.
Thank you.
Sure.
Chair Rumbach, go ahead and introduce your bill, or it's here. Would you like to move the bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to go ahead and move House File 418, and it will be laid over for inclusion in the possible omnibus bill.
Very good. And then you have two author's amendments?
Yes, I do. And the A1 just add some requirements that as the legislature looks at these large light rail projects, that there be a lot more specificity in terms of real import criteria, the co-location when that occurs, how that's going to be handled, what are the safety criteria, how do we incorporate safety standards into those corridors, a prohibition of carrying oil and other hazardous substances, that sort of thing. So that's the A1 amendment, and the A2 simply refers to the Department of Transportation.
Okay, I will move the A1 and A2 amendments to get the bill in the shape. Oh, okay, we'll take one at a time. For the A1 amendment, those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. I will move the A2 amendment. Those in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails and the A2 amendment is adopted. Chair Rumbach, please present your bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My bill addresses somewhat of a similar topic as Representative Nash's, and that is that we are in the midst of building out a $8, possibly $10 billion transit network in the Twin Cities, and we find ourselves a little bit at the end of the process. The state has asked for money well after we have spent, in some cases, $120 million in studies, in design, in proposals, and putting together the application to the federal government. And, you know, I guess the question really is, because the Met Council is an unelected body, it does not report to the legislature. It is not accountable to any elected officials save one, the governor. We have not taken votes on the projects, explicit votes on these projects, and we don't even, like many metro areas that are doing similar scale projects, we are not allowing the public to have a public referenda. If you look at what's gone on in Detroit, in Seattle, in Denver, Indianapolis, and other cities, those projects at least have the opportunity for the public to weigh in and to cast their vote on whether they want that kind of burden of debt placed upon them. And so our system here, I guess, started in 2008, not very long ago, finds us in a position where we have bought into, without really buying into, in any acknowledgeable way, an enormous public investment that is going to require a substantial and permanent subsidy on the part of taxpayers for the operations, for the capital repair, and some 20, 25 years down the road, the capital replacement. And we've seen capital replacement going on in cities like L.A., and where just, you know, 23, 24 years later, they are being required to replace the whole trackage and cars and stations, et cetera. So it's an enormous investment, and, you know, whoever, all the folks who voted on this in 2008, really what was their anticipation, what was their expectation? Probably none of them expected that, you know, it was going to require potentially $1 billion in transit sales taxes by the time we're looking at trying to build all these. And so this bill simply says, let's put the cart before the horse, or the horse before the cart. Let's start where we should start in these projects and make certain that when it comes to long-term permanent investments and capital dollars and tax dollars, that we have the proper go-ahead, the proper green light from the legislative branch. And the legislative branch created CTIB. Obviously, Met Council is an arm and a branch of the legislature as well. So it is in our, I think, is totally justified that we would say we want a more involved process, and not just to backdoor it and not to, you know, back into these projects. So that's essentially the bill. It's very short and simple. And so that basically, is where we're at.
Thank you, Chair Rumbeck. We have a couple testifiers on the list here. If anybody not on my list, I've got David Lilly, Shep Harris, and Judge Shetland. Anybody not on the list, maybe I'll notify the page, please, and the page will let me know. And would you like to have your testifier, David Lilly?
Mr. Lilly, would you like to come forward and give us your viewpoint?
Representative Hornstein, did you have a question?
No, I can wait till after the testimony.
Okay, thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record. Welcome to the committee, and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Acting Chair, Madam Chair, David Lilly from Minneapolis. I am here today as a representative of a group called LRT Done Right, a grassroots organization with over 600 supporters. I am here to express our wholehearted support of House File 418 and the A1 and A2 amendments, as well as House File 800, which was considered earlier. The need for such legislation is obvious to those of us who have tried over the course of many years to understand and meaningfully participate in a process which is about to result in the single biggest public works project in Minnesota history, and, it turns out, without the benefit of legislative review. When, in the last minute of last year's session, the legislature turned down an attempt by proponents of Southwest LRT to fund the project via a county taxing mechanism, we were relieved. We concluded, frankly and wrongly, that the result would be, at a minimum, to slow down this project until this body had an opportunity to review and evaluate it. But the Met Council, the governor, and Hennepin County decided to go rogue and managed to pull the proverbial rabbit out of a hat by authorizing the issuance of certificates of participation and blowing up CTIB, two backroom deals if ever I've heard of them. And totally inconsistent with the original LRT authorizing statute that essentially presumed that this body would have some oversight authority. Well, apparently where there is the will, there is a loophole. Setting aside for a moment the certificates of participation, it's important to note that dissolving CTIB will upend legislative intent. It will result in there being no mechanism for coordination of any of these light rail projects or other transit projects affecting multiple counties and jurisdictions. The go-it-alone mentality exhibited by the Met Council and its enablers flies in the face of the state's enormous interest in building and maintaining a coordinated statewide transportation system. The only way to restore rational transportation planning and policy is, as House File 418 requires, to require legislative authorization. Only then will the public have a meaningful opportunity to participate. I have more that I could say, but I think the hour is late and the committee has been at work for quite a while today. be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lilly. We appreciate your consideration. Representative Hornstein, do you want to wait, save your question until later? Or
after all the testimony, if that's okay.
That's perfectly fine. Mr. Shatner, do you want to go towards the end?
It doesn't matter.
Okay. Yep. we'll go next, Mr. Shep Harris. Oh, he's not here? Okay. Patricia Nauman.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much for the opportunity to comment this
evening.
Please
proceed.
Yes. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the executive director of Metro Cities, and Metro Cities does wish to express respectful opposition to House File 418, just from the simple premise that it does impinge on local control and spending options that cities are authorized to make under state law and does usurp the municipal consent process that is in place for projects such as that we're talking about tonight.
The meetings and forums and gone to the meetings that the young man spoke of.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Sims. Glad that you did participate in some of those public hearings. Members, we have a couple questions. Representative Hornstein, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Representative Runbeck, I wanted to express my appreciation for lines 116 through 120 in the A1 amendment. I've been raising those questions a lot, particularly through the EIS process, the supplemental EIS process. So I think you're getting at some important questions, and I think there's also issues of liability. In the Transportation Finance Committee, I asked about liability for Class 3 railroads, and I think you might have been there, I don't remember, but no one from the railroad industry or the state could answer definitively whether what kind of liability insurance is covered in the freight industry. And I'm particularly, you know, sensitive to the Kenilworth corridor where there will be co-location. So that language is good. I wanted to ask you, though, so there's an ongoing lawsuit related to the routing of this of the Southwest Light Rail project. And basically the argument is that the Met Council preordained the route. And so there's evidence back and forth on that. If, and it's very difficult to predict the judicial system, but I know that there's going to be a decision in, later this year. And under the circumstance where they conclude that, that the routing through Kenilworth, you know, needs to be addressed, would this bill apply to, you know, if another route was chosen, for example, along Nicollet Avenue? That was one of the possibilities. There's a through the Midtown Greenway and Uptown, and then it would take a left turn onto Nicollet coming from the southwest. Would this apply to that? If that became the preferred alternative as a result of a legal decision, would your bill still apply?
Chair Runbeck?
Representative Hornstein, it becomes effective the day after enactment. I suspect that there could be a case made that the legislature has, you know, has approved Southwest Light Rail. Is that what you're asking?
Well,
the $37 million.
Let's say if some kind of decision is made as a result of this lawsuit, and I, again, one would have to, I don't know what would happen. I suppose three quarters of the line has gone through, you know, engineering and environmental review, so they might have to redo this last part of it through Minneapolis. Would your bill still apply in that situation? Would the legislature still have to approve this new alignment?
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, my answer would be, actually, I hope it would. I hope it would. I think that there's a number of counts about Southwest Light Rail on which the process has been flawed. I just talk about the EIS that did not, the initial draft EIS did not talk even about a co-located freight rail and a passenger rail. And neither did the supplemental. So there has been, you know, that's been a tragic, I think, omission. And folks are very, and justifiably, very concerned. There is information that the no-build option in the case of Southwest is better environmentally than building Southwest Light Rail as it's planned and designed. You have the issue of the Minneapolis parks and the acreage of pristine parkland that is, you know, is going to be corrupted. So, I mean, I think there are any number of reasons why it would be important to
follow up.
Go back.
Representative Hornstein?
Sure. Well, thank you. You know, the co-location was addressed in the supplemental environmental impact statement. I would argue not very well.
Okay.
I had right. comments to that effect, but it was addressed. I guess my concern is, you know, there are we have so many projects in transportation that we deal with through the legislative process. You know, big projects. One could argue even wasteful projects. And it seems like if we do this, we would now, would the Stillwater Bridge have had to go through the legislative approval? I mean, we'll be kind of, would have 134 members of the Transportation Committee, and it seems like that's all we'd be doing is approving one project or turning down one project after another. It just sets a precedent. So, I mean, I'm sympathetic to parts of your A1 amendment, and I do want to work with you on that. I think we could look at liability. We could look at some other questions. But, you know, I just think we're kind of, again, if some issues around, you know, Kenilworth are resolved in the legal process and we have another route, I think to have to go to the legislature on that, I think would be, you know, a little bit of a stretch. So, but I do like part of your amendment, and we can, and I'd like to work with you on that.
Okay, great, I'd be
very good.
To do that.
Chair Rumbeck, and then we'll Representative Barr R will be next. But feel free to make some comments if you, Chair Rumbeck.
Well, I only was going to offer. I don't know if Mr. Lilly has any reflections on that, but I'd be happy to work with the chair or with the lead
okay.
on that issue. So there may be some other language that. You know, consolidates, let's say, how some of the...
Okay, seeing Mr. Lilly, welcome back to the committee. Reintroduce yourself for the record and offer some brief, concise comments if you like.
David Lilly, LRT done right. And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what I'm being asked to comment about. I was distracted.
Yes, Representative Hornstein had a brief question. To follow up with?
Not specifically with Mr. Lilly.
No, okay.
Mr. Chair, I do have some peculiar insight into the litigation because I am a board member of the entity that is, in fact, suing
okay.
that concept.
Mr. Lilly, please make a few comments then.
Only to reflect that the litigation is real, that the preliminary rulings we've gotten out of federal Judge Thunheim have been favorable to our claim. And the basic claim was that the Met Council failed to study alternatives as required by law in the second environmental impact statement and actually going back to the original scoping process. So there was never a good faith evaluation of options, as Representative Ornstein has pointed out. And I think that one of the hopes of the litigants, and I hope the legislature, is that a favorable resolution of the lawsuit would result in a reconsideration of the route that would actually serve more people. The route right now, I mean, Martin Szabo literally on his deathbed said this claim about transit equity is baloney. And Martin Szabo, as we all know, was one of the great progressive congressmen of Minnesota and cared a great deal about equity. Anyone who looks at a map of the route knows that the route intentionally bypasses population in Minneapolis that could use and benefit from light rail transit.
All right.
So.
Okay, thank you. Representative Barr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Shetnin, if he's still here. Yes. And my question is, I'm just wondering if you could tell us, as it relates to light rail, how many studies do you do on a year or over a couple-year period of time, and what's the average cost of those studies when you're doing the planning?
Mr. Chair and Representative Barr, the council,
and Mr. Shannon,
serving as the region's MPO, we have to create a document called the Transportation Policy Plan, which is a long-range plan for what the region will look like as far as transit investment and road investment. And so we are constantly in the process of redoing and updating that Transportation Policy Plan. So I can't tell you exactly what the cost is, but I know that we have an update coming to that plan this fall. And that update is also the information that's being used to update the guideway status report that's required by the legislature. And so all of that information will remain consistent as it has over the previous years when we have done those same studies that we are required to do, not only by state law, but through federal law as well.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what is the cost of those studies?
Mr. Chair, and Representative, if it's okay, I'd have to get back to you on that. That is, we have a specific department called our Metropolitan Transportation Services Department. Nick Thompson, who was with me here last week when we talked about the transportation planning process, that's Nick's division. Okay. And so I can find out what that is, but I just can't tell you off the top of my head. But we do have one specific group that works on these plans.
Representative Barr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, because when I'm looking at House File 418, and I'm not sure if this is exactly what Representative Runbeck is getting at, but, you know, my experience is often that when we invest in a planning study and we spend significant dollars, we're reluctant ever to say no to a project. And so that's my one concern. If we've got all these, you know, we get so far into doing these studies, we spend money, and then it's like we feel like we can't turn back. So thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Mr. Chair.
Briefly, please.
Sure. Related to that, we actually brought this. This was a slide as part of the transportation planning presentation that we made that shows that generally the beginning phase of looking at these transitways is done at the local level, normally through the county level or through a regional rail authority. And so all of these feasibility studies, alternatives analysis, selecting a locally preferred alternative, that occurs at the local end before it even comes to the council.
Representative Byron, another follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Final question. Where and how are those feasibility studies funded? Do we know what those cost?
Mr. Shatner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would going to guess that much of that comes through a county's regional rail authority. And those studies aren't just for light rail transit projects either. I mean, we did these going back to the Orange Line. We looked at them related to the Red Rock, the Rush Line, the Green Line, the Bottineau Extension. All of these begin that process generally at the very local level. And so that would be a question probably for the Dakota County Regional Rail Authority. And I'm willing to bet that former Representative Holberg would be able to tell you how they're funding it in Dakota County. But generally, it is done that way. And
thank you,
I was going to say, Mr. Chair, members, moving on, then that's where we then come to the legislature to receive additional funding to do that and also work with our partners at CTIP.
Good.
And if I could, then just to
go ahead.
Tack on to that, your response to your question, so that was one of the key findings in the Legislative Auditor's 2011 report of transit governance. And their key finding was that there are 22 different agencies involved in the planning or the funding or the operation of light rail, which means that nobody is in control. Nobody's in charge. I mean, how can you have such a multi-headed, you know, thing? So I think that, you know, it all points back to that. This is not the way to do it. Nobody knew it at the beginning what we were getting into exactly. And who's in control, it's really not clear.
Question from Representative Hertas, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shedden, you've done other presentations before this committee, and I commend the Met Council for your work with providing infrastructure with regard to wastewater treatment. And I think that the Met Council has done that admirably and basically got its origin in that area of expertise. But I'm really concerned about your characterization of what you seem to suggest, that disclosure of what you're doing is oversight.
I'm really troubled by that. It seems to be such a recalcitrant attitude towards the legislature, certainly giving the direction that the legislature wants legislative oversight over your spending. And it's really troubling that we're talking about you folks having a vision of spending $30 billion on fixed rail for about 3% of total ridership in this state, dragging along the state of Minnesota for all of the operating costs. You don't fund in any of your projections the cost of the capital outlay to build these things, the depreciation for it, and you just talk about operating costs in terms of just paying for people to run the trains. This is really troubling that we're talking about spending five times the amount of money on fixed rail for what is the amount of money that would be spent for an entire transportation program over the next 10 years. Most of us have agreed in the last legislative session that the number is $6 billion for all roads and bridges. And that's for 95% of Minnesotans. And this notion that you can drag along and plan an infinite number of lines and expect the state to pay for the operating deficits is very, very troubling. Now, you mentioned about city approval, that everybody signed off on this. But again, I mentioned earlier today about the coercion that goes along in that process of getting these cities to agree to this stuff. It's hang the big lollipop out in front of them to get them to sign on. And, you know, you're not budgeting for transit-oriented development. You're not. Where's all this money coming from? This is all this great vision that this transportation, what is this? Is this a transportation project or a jobs bill? Because that's what you talk about, all of the extra peripheral things this is going to do. That might be all well and good, but we're trying to solve a transportation crisis in this region. And having fixed rail isn't going to solve it. Even by your own projections in Thrive, you're going to take 9,500 people off the roads by 2040. That's preposterous. We're talking about billions and billions of dollars. I don't understand where you're coming from, and even though the chair of the Met Council had stated that you're going to not proceed without legislative approval, you just go right ahead around and do it anyway, go and move to disband CTIP, go ahead and issue the COPS, just do everything that is an end run around the legislature. Extremely frustrating, and that's why you're hearing the bills coming forth right now. I don't know if you want to answer any of the questions. That's my editorialization. No, I was going to say that if you had a specific question,
well, there are
your comments are fine.
There's certainly questions buried in there.
Mr. Shetland, I will let you reply somewhat concisely, please.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertas. I appreciate your comments. That is, those are fair. But what I would say is, when you look at the council's long-range plan, our transportation policy plan, and how we look to fund those, what the administration has proposed going back to 2013 is a regional sales tax. And that regional sales tax is how other regions, our peer regions, fund transit. And so what we propose and what we're proposing again this year is to get the state out of funding the transitway program. And when we talk about that, we have this heavy perspective on pursuing rail. I would say of the 20 transitways that we're proposing, only three of them are light rail lines, and one of them is the Southwest line. So there aren't, like, there are a number of light rail lines, you know, that we are planning. It's included in our long-range plan. It just shows that most of them are busways. And so I don't want to debate the numbers with you on that. I'd like to look at the information that you have, because when you look at the council's long-range plan, that isn't even necessarily the council's funds. Our long-range plan includes all the federal money that would potentially come along. It would include money from our regional partners, meaning CTIB and the regional rail authorities. And so these the numbers, I would love to sit down and look at these with you so maybe we can figure out where we may have a difference of opinion on that. But I would just like to say again that what the council is attempting to do here is to bring forward a regional transit system, and I think that we have been pretty clear and transparent about what those plans are, and have that opportunity to have the discussion with the legislature to potentially move off of the state bonding, to move away from the state operating, and put it on a sales tax, and then we wouldn't be back before the legislature seeking these funds anymore.
Mr. Chair. Representative Hertas.
Well, Mr. Shetland, I mean,
you have now just described what the funding mechanism was, and it really is seems to be my understanding, and maybe I should stand corrected, but my understanding is when other counties had the authority to raise sales tax, part of the deal was is that CTIP was created for these seven metro counties in exchange for limiting your sales tax ability. Okay, you didn't get the same privilege to raise the amount of sales tax revenue that the other counties did in terms of their transit priorities within their counties. In exchange for that, the legislature basically said, okay, if you do it that way, we'll pick up 50% of your operating costs. Well, now you're walking away from that and disbanding CTIP and still expect the state to be dragged along, claiming that you're going to pay for it with county dollars. No, you're not. You're going to be paying for it with general fund dollars, because funding from the general fund, your operating deficits, which you do not include the capital depreciation or replacement of that, you're going to have a system that's worn out, and you're using general fund dollars, which every state taxpayer in this state is paying. So this is not a paid for by the metro, go ahead and let them raise the money in the metro, let the metro pay for their train, let them build their train. This is state money. This is state money that is depriving education, depriving the judiciary, and other priorities that we have in the state. And so this is the frustration that I have with regard to what is clearly looking like it's just going around the legislature in terms of having oversight. I don't think that disbanding CTIB really gives you the authority to be dragged along, and some have disagreed with me. Maybe it's in statute. Maybe we need to change that statute. But what was the legislative intent back then? We weren't talking about additional lines. We were talking about a line at that time. And this is really frustrating.
Thank you, Representative Hertas.
Well, Representative,
you want to reply?
Well, I would like to just clarify something, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Real briefly, Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas.
And this will be the end of it, though, and we'll move on to the next question.
Absolutely. Thank you. I can stop now if you'd prefer.
But I'll let you, if you have something to say, please go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hertas, related to CTIB, the County's Transit Improvement Board, that became a entity in 2008. And what that allowed was the metropolitan area counties to decide whether or not they wanted to levy a half cent or a quarter cent sales tax for transitway capital and transitway operating. What that didn't do is fund the regular route bus system. And so what you're looking at today is what was also a legislative piece to that deal was that those counties, if they were going to come together as a joint powers board, that they weren't going to be able to levy an additional quarter cent. But the other 82 counties in the state had that opportunity to levy up to a half cent. So what you're seeing today, and the council is not CTIB. I just need to make that very clear. See, those counties are county boards. They can do what they want. And what they are looking to do is potentially disband. And one of the options that they have at that point is to go ahead and stay at the quarter cent if they'd like, or go to the half cent. And that is, I think, what some counties are deliberating. But I just want to be clear to the members that that is not the council's decision. These are not our dollars. And so I just, out of total respect to you, Representative Hertas, I just want to make sure that you understand that.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Representative Hertas.
I appreciate that explanation. However, you cannot tell me that the Met Council and CTIB and all of this isn't all hinged together. You're all sharing a vision, and you're all working and colluding together to make your vision, the Met Council's vision, a reality. And again, you know, even the FTA said they weren't going to fully commit this until this Lakes and Parks Alliance litigation is disposed of in September of this year. And yet you continue to plow money into something in which you don't know the outcome yet. That just doesn't seem to be very fiscally responsible. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Representative Hertas. Representative Joachim, question, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, a lot of clarifications and then a few questions, because there's a lot of alternative facts flying around, and I'm trying to decide if my heart rate's where it was in spin class this morning or above it. $6 billion for the transportation plan that we've all agreed on that we need to do our roads and bridges is over 10 years is actually just to maintain and have what we currently have and barely expand it. I wish we had a guideway status report for roads like we do for what Green Making Met Council do for all transit projects, because we could really get down to the nitty-gritty on lifetime ongoing operating costs of roads and how they're subsidized, which I think we could all use a discussion around that. I think Representative Hornstein actually explained that in the DEIS and the supplemental budget, we had talked about supplemental DEIS. They did talk about co-locating, because all along, Southwest Light Rail has been co-located with rail through St. Louis Park and Hopkins. And I should know, I've been on the city council when, well, it's been, let's see, 20 years in discussion, 10 years in planning for Southwest Light Rail, and it all started at the local level. And I think we tried to walk folks through that, but I'll reiterate, there's a locally preferred alternative process that starts at the local level where there are tons of input in community sessions, on city councils, and as Ms. Sims in the audience said, that she came to a lot of them, that there were thousands of citizens that had input on this. So what this bill does, and I'll get back to the bill, House File 418,
we would appreciate that. Thank you.
Takes away all the local control and takes those folks' voices and throws them under the proverbial bus. This is the state legislature standing on top of the head of local governments again, once again. This process starts at the local level. It's been vetted at the local level. It's been voted on at the local level. And I wish I had the hours back then, if you're just going to toss it away, that we've spent, and the time and the energy and the staff dollars we've spent looking at these projects, because our communities need it so badly. And I know you mentioned that, you know, is this an economic development project? Is it a jobs project? You see, we'd like to talk about what it does for people, and for ridership, and for getting people off the roads, getting people to work, doing it in an efficient manner. But the language that seems to reverberate around here is about jobs and the economic development. So we try to talk in that language, too. So that's why that's always thrown out here. And you can tell I am very passionate about this. But when you sit and say that local voices haven't been heard, I can't go back to my constituents and say I'm not fighting for them and their local voices that have been heard for over a decade on this project. So I just wanted to throw that out there, and maybe, Mr. Shutnan, could you once again explain and maybe get the page to make a copy of that document that you brought on how this process starts at the beginning with the local level and the counties going through this. And in Section 1 of the bill, you take away the county authority, which are county taxpayers and elected bodies that go over it. Section 2, you take away city authority and home rule charters, statutory cities, which are elected bodies that go through this process. And you don't even allow them to plan for future lines, which leaves out the whole entire East Metro when it comes to expanding lines. So maybe we could just briefly go over what a locally preferred alternative process looks like. Thank you.
Members, I just want to remind us, you know, we're putting in extra hours, and I think this is great discussion. We're going to try to keep it to the bill. Please respond if you'd like, Mr. Shetman, and we'll I am going to try to tighten it up a little bit, though.
Mr. Chair, this goes right to the bill with the locally preferred alternatives that
Representative, we're going to let the question be asked, but I'm just making general comment. Mr. Shetnan, if you have something.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I did give the copy of the of the phasing to the page. And, again, these projects start as a feasibility study, or generally a city or a county or a regional rail authority will look at a particular route and try to figure out if there is a basis for investing in a transit way of some sort. And so they'll look at a variety of things. So then that is called the alternatives analysis, where they'll look at is should it be a busway, should it be a BRT, should it be LRT, should it be commuter rail, or should it be built at all? I mean, there is a no-build aspect that looks at these as well.
Mr. Shutnick, could I ask a question? Has there ever been a light rail project proposed that was determined not to be feasible, a good idea? Mr. Shutnam?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, I know that when we look at the different alternatives, that LRT has been dismissed in some corridors and moved forward with LRT, particularly along the 35W corridor. To bring LRT in that corridor would not work because of the expense of getting across the 35W bridge. But there are when you look at the alternatives, we look at all of the different alternatives. And so I think that there have been plenty of times when a particular alternative has been dismissed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Shutnan. Representative Petersburg has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Shetland, for your presentation. It doesn't appear that transit is emotional at all around here, right? The question, so I'm going to bring this back down to a little bit more of how I look at things. And for me, this bill and discussions around this isn't about transit and whether or not we ought to do that or not. I am a big proponent that we do need to provide low-income transportation and so forth. But my question gets back to kind of this plan that is presented to the legislature that you say happens every other year, I believe, in the fall. When does the legislature have the authority or ability to deny or decline the dollars for this particular plan? And then I have some follow-up.
Absolutely. Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair and members, the plan, it gets updated every 2 years, so we'll have one this fall. When we bring it forward, there are plans that are in the queue, and there are long-term projects. And so what the legislature does is look at them generally in the past. So we did the Central Corridor Line. We did it through bonding. And so the legislature chose to fund $70 million in 2008 for Central Corridor, and then had $5.25 million a couple years before that to work all its way up to the $93.5 million that the state put into that project. When we did the A-Line project that runs from the Rosedale Mall down Snelling Avenue, takes a right at Ford Parkway and connects to the Blue Line, we did that through a cash, a general fund cash back in 2013, and we also did that through some general, general obligation bonding. We did the same thing with, the Orange Line, when we've had money, bonding dollars that have gone through that. So the legislature hears these projects, they come forward, and there's many members at the committee here who actually have bills related to transit ways today. And so the legislature has the opportunity to look at that and decide whether or not they would like to invest in it or not. And so that is also an opportunity for our other partners who have the ability to come forward and fund those if the legislature does not step forward and view that as a project that they'd like to move forward.
Follow-up? And the follow-up then is that kind of was kind of my anticipated answer, was that it's kind of reverse order. When the plan comes forward, and if we fund it, that's great. If we don't, you continue right on with it, even though Dad's credit card is on the line, shall we say. And that's where kind of where I think it comes into where we really deal with the oversight piece of this, is that by statute currently, we are on the hook as a state legislature for 50% of the cost of running that particular light rail program, even if we didn't approve it, because it, you know, we do want to have local communities being involved with that planning. We do want to have them being involved with all the decisions up to that point, and I don't disregard that, and I think that's very important. However, when the dollars then come to needing support from the state legislature, and the state legislature is either you support it or we're going to move ahead and you still pay for it, that's not really a direct oversight, in my opinion. And so I think it's important for us to know that what we're talking about here, when we have to, at the legislature, prioritize all the funding sources we have for transportation system and for the other, that it's important for us to at least be able to control our own dollars that we have to put into this. And a plan that does not meet with positive results from the legislature, as Southwest Light Rail apparently has not over the years, but still going to be coming to the legislature and saying, by law you have to pay for it anyway, there should be some discussion or some concern about what that means. And I think that's just a very valid that part. I think there's a difference between support and local funding versus state mandating funds. And that's where the concern that I have is how do we get around the idea that if we have the ability to see a plan and we don't like it, how do we then say then we ought not to have to fund it because it's not something in the state's interest that we approve?
Those are some comments from Mr. Shetland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg. I appreciate the perspective that you're bringing to this, and I understand what the committee is doing and what this bill does. The difference is that when we began seeking funds for this project back in 2009, this was the statute that is in place. And so we operate based on current law. And we know that some people may not support this line. We do know that. But the process that we move forward is working with current law, current statute that says the state will pay 50%. Now, I can go back to 2015, I can go back to 2013, 2011, and we have this debate when we negotiate the budget bills. But the fact is that when we put forward our package for these projects, Southwest in particular, we base it off of what state statute says that the state is going to pay 50%. And so that's where we're at. And what we have, and I mentioned this, is we have an alternative idea that would, again, get the state out of this altogether and have this be done through a regional sales tax. And I know that there's probably a difference of opinion on this as well, but these are the options that we have. But until something changes, we operate under current law.
Representative Petersburg.
And this, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, thank you. And this will be just very brief. I think that's part of the reason why we're bringing these legislation forward, because there may be something which we want to change in regards to how we authorize additional funding into the future. Because an unlimited credit card, shall we say, without any control is no different than me giving my credit card to my college student daughter and say, here, I know you've got what you need for the school, but here, just spend whatever you want. And I think that's prudent for us to do it, and I'm hoping that we will have some traction, and I hope we can work with the Met Council to figure out something that is realistic that they can also depend upon within the parameters of the planning process.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Mason?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rundeck, this bill is alarming for a number of reasons to me, but I'm going to concentrate on the fact that is it once again another Republican bill that's stripping away local control. And I'll read your bill. Says cities, counties, they're prohibited from spending any money to study, plan, or design. And what do you expect city councils, commissioners to do? I mean, you have to start with ideas. You have to work at them. You have to be doing something. So are we going to do away with all local government? How could you do that? You're stripping away local control. So is the ultimate deal is to get rid of city councils and county commissioners?
Chair Rombeck, does this bill get rid of local government?
Representative Mason, the organizational structure overlap, taxing authorities, I mean, needs to be relooked at. I mean, this is a backwards process. So perhaps it starts with some very grand scheme and the costs are identified, so at least ballpark, and then the planning and the designing and so on goes forward, perhaps under the auspices of the Met Council, that sort of thing. But what we have now, is fraught with all kinds of I think, discouraging kinds of situations and tensions and so on that exist between local governments and so on. So we just, need to do it from scratch.
Follow-up, Representative Mason.
So what do you expect a city council member to do? I think previous council member across from me told you what she was doing when she was on the city council. So do you expect council members to do absolutely nothing and just go in and, I mean, you're always visioning. That is a job of most elected officials, is to put together a plan, and mainly, if you're doing your job right and your predecessors did their job right, you're concentrating 10, 15 years out. You're not going back every 2 years to redo stuff. I mean, so...
Well, I can't sit here and describe what all the pieces would need, how they would need to be reorganized and reordered. Certainly, the idea is not to strip cities and counties of involvement in the process in determining their own needs. And certainly, there's an aspect of the transportation policy plan. Perhaps we start there. I mean, what do What does that look like, and what is the feedback and the input that cities have as that is prepared? But that's more than this bill does. It is simply saying that what we are doing now has way too many entities involved. No one knows the real outcome. And we have an extraordinarily and probably grossly inefficient, inaccessible transit system that is planning to be developed and constructed here.
One more follow-up.
Thank you.
Representative Mason.
Again, if I'm reading your bill, is prohibited from spending any money to study, plan, design, or construct. That you have taken away their power to do anything. Well, how can you say you're not?
Representative, that what we've seen today where a county starts spending taxpayer dollars to design something that not until 3 or 4 or 5 years later is it part of a major project with an identifiable cost and perpetual subsidies required. When we're talking about light rail, a fixed rail project, you don't change that. I mean, that's in the ground. It's not going to lend itself to newer technologies, a rethinking of the transit system, and so on. We are backing into these projects, starting from the very smallest piece. So.
Thank you, Chair Rumbeck. I've got Representative Joachim and Representative Kegel and Bernardi, and then, you know, hopefully we're, you know, I appreciate the discussion. I think it's important to have. So, Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Rumbeck. I appreciate what you're trying to do, and I even understand maybe we do need to start from scratch. But usually when you do that, you go forward, you don't go backwards. This is going backwards retroactively and destroying decades of planning and community input. That concerns me, and I can take that offline and have a long discussion maybe over a bottle of wine over that, which would probably be a lot better for both of us. But you mentioned that, you know, light rail is a fixed line, but separate BRT guideways that are built and constructed are fixed lines too. So I'm still a little confused to why that was not included. And I can't reiterate enough that all these projects start with local control. And all the alternatives are looked at that level. And it's just so important that you're having folks be able to participate in the body that's closest to them. And that's what's so hard about looking at a bill like this that completely takes that control away. So maybe you can just mention the BRT and why you did not include that then. Why retroactive?
Chair Rumbeck.
Representative, I would be, this is going to be looked at, in the next couple of weeks, and I'd be happy to, if there's language that makes more sense, we can certainly refine it. The idea being, however, that the state needs to play a bigger role, given that we are, you know, expected to be partners and expected to have state taxpayers, you know, play a major role. So I'd be happy to visit with you about what might, you know, in some cases sound more reasonable.
Mr. Chair, maybe the retroactivity piece, why you're undoing decades of planning.
Yeah, I'm not certain I see that, but that doesn't seem to work. Work on that, Representative.
Representative Kegel.
I'm sorry.
Kegel. I'll learn it. I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Rumbeck, you and I both live in Anoka County. So let's say that Anoka County wanted to expand its transit. Blaine's growing, Andover's growing. Would Anoka County be able then to spend dollars to look at LRT to see if it was a feasible option? Or are we telling them basically you can only look at these modes of transportation like buses or flying cars or whatever it might be, but we're saying you can't even look at LRT.
Chair Rumbeck.
Representative Kegel, I mean, there are certainly relationships that are not within the purview of this bill to talk about how those entities all work together in a system, the regional rail, and so on. Not here to prepare to spell that out. People obviously have to be able to think about these things, talked to their Met Council representative. Obviously, there's a lot that is always ongoing in terms of where we need to be, where we want to be. So,
Representative Cagle, follow up.
So, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, from what I understand, we're prohibiting our county to even study whether LRT would be feasible. So I guess I'm just really curious, would Anoka County be able to look at LRT, or would that be forbidden for the county?
Chair Rombeck?
The assumption is that there is a, for starters, there is a grand design that everyone is, you know, participating in, developing. The counties have their role. Regional Rail has its role. So that may be something we can spell out in some better language. So,
I guess, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cagle?
Well, you know, from my reading the bill, it says that they are prohibited to even study whether it would be feasible. So we're taking that off the table right away. They can't even look to see if it would make sense. And so I think that's really kind of handcuffing our local.
So the question, Mr. Senator, Mr. Chair, I mean, where do these projects start? When does the clock start ticking? When do the dollars start being spent? You know, somewhere between what this says and 3, 4, 5 years down the road, after millions of dollars have been spent, is a better place.
So,
this
Cagle?
Is where we're trying to get to.
I'm sorry.
Well,
your point has been made. I think. Do you have another follow-up? Or no? Okay. Representative Bernardi, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am really concerned about, you know, taking away local control, and I can see this theory or this concept being, you know, what's next? Are we going to be doing taking away local control for our local roadways and having to add having to decide the legislature whether this collaboration early on that happens at the local level, that people are elected to be able to bring forth these projects and work together, that we're going to not only pull the rug under light rail, but BRT, our local roadways, our highway system, are we going to be micromanaging those projects? I just see a real issue here when I hear words like nobody knew about it or nobody knew what was going on. I'm wondering, I'm feeling when you're saying that you mean the legislature versus, because there's a lot of people that have been involved in this for many years who do know what's going on, and they've been moving it forward and going through the process that's required to advance these projects. So I want to state my concern and hope we can fix this language, that we're not going backwards and on pulling the rug out from all the community involvement, local involvement by community members and elected officials, and then about moving forward and taking away local control in the future, and that we're isolating one mode of transportation and we're not putting the same criteria on all the other modes of transportation. It doesn't seem just, and I feel like we
well,
can't take away local control.
Mr. Chairman, Bernardi, I mean, I think there's probably many, many ways to approach this better. You know, each county is a part of a whole. And, you know, perhaps each one has to have their plan that fits with the bigger plan. I mean, it's just that right now, it is a backward process. And, you know, we deserve to have a better process, it seems to me, where much more is known, much more is understood about the costs of where we're going with this, and much more about the details in terms of what the final product is.
Thank you, Chair Rumbeck. Any other questions from members? Very good. Seeing none, I will renew Chair Rumbeck's motion that House File 418 be laid over as amended for possible inclusion. Very good. Next on the agenda is House File 1160. Chair Rombeck, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'll move House File 1160, and it will be laid over for possible inclusion as well.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Chair Rombeck, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The bill here is before us because of the existence of a proposal to dissolve CTIB. And CTIB is an entity we've been talking about, created in 2008. It's been a pass-through agency receiving transit tax revenues. And over the last 8 years, I don't have the actual number, but $1 billion rather of sales tax revenue. It has authorized debt in the hundreds of millions. Its actions affect the metro counties, certainly the five that are members of CTIB, as well as the future direction of the proposed transitway system. So the legislature created CTIB in 2008, and it has an interest in overseeing, if it occurs, the dissolution of CTIB. And this bill recognizes that there's a lot of information to be learned in the process and to be answered in terms of the financial viability, the financial forecast, the financial audit information of CTIB, and many questions that because the legislature is in the position it is, we need to have that information. So I'm proposing that the Office of the Legislative Auditor be involved in this, that they have someone involved in overseeing CTIB in its dissolution, and they would be a partner of the legislature in answering a lot of sort of unknowns. I mean, what happens, you know, with the tax? Does it shut off? What happens in the period between the time, the date of dissolution and when the tax is concluded? What about the financial implications of the COPs? If counties are preparing to adopt their own resolution to tax the half-cent sales tax, what's involved in that? What kind of legislation might be needed? What kind of startup costs are there going to be to that? So many, many things, and because the legislative auditor is the entity that, you know, answers so many questions that the legislature has, provides key recommendations, findings that are very valuable, and is a very neutral party to all of this, I believe that they are the best to handle and provide this information as CTIB is in the process of changing, perhaps dissolving. So that's really what the bill does.
Thank you, Chair Rumbach. Do you have any testifiers in support of your bill?
I have asked the Office of the Legislative Auditor to at least say that it's something that's in their wheelhouse, that they would be prepared to do. So they are available.
Seeing Mr. Noble's approach, it would be appropriate.
Good evening.
Welcome to the committee. I appreciate you staying here. I know we're working a little later tonight. Please introduce yourself for the record and offer any testimony that you have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor. I'm always happy to be with any legislative committee. And this is clearly something that we do. We're auditors. We're financial analysts. And the legislature sets the terms of our jurisdiction, our responsibilities, so we're quite comfortable with this if this is what the will of the legislature is.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions for Auditor Nobles? All right. Representative Mason?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. Now, the state auditor does do an audit for this entity. So would it be that, or maybe I should ask Chair Rumbach first, so is there something that's not in that, if you've read that part, is there something that's not in there that you want this legislative auditor to do?
Chair Rumbach.
I'll start with you.
Or Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chair, members, the legislative auditor, as you know, has jurisdiction over state agencies and a number of metropolitan organizations, and the state auditor does local units of government. But We often do evaluations and other financial analysis where the state auditor has jurisdiction to do a financial statement audit. We actually, as you've heard here tonight, done a number of studies of transit that involved counties, local units of government, Metropolitan Council. So even though the state auditor could certainly do and has done and may well continue to do some financial audits of the Metropolitan Council, this is a very special situation, as Representative Runbeck explained, of the possible disillusionment of an organization that was established under the legislative authorization. So it's a special assignment which we get from the legislature from time to time. So I think it's quite consistent with what you do. I don't know if I completely answered your question, but if not, please ask me again.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Representative Joachim?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles, this bill also addresses Met Council and CTIP for quarterly reports, and on line 1.19 and 1.20, it requires to appoint a fiscal oversight officer with duties that include performing the review under this section. How much more staff time, and is this going to have to entail another FTE to do this, or I'm just a little confused to why the redundancy in the bill.
Mr. Nobles?
Mr. Chair, members, we are preparing a fiscal note that will be ready, I believe, tomorrow or the next day, but I know what it's going to say. It will suggest that we probably will need about a half-time person to do this work, and frankly, it would be assigned to somebody who's already within the Office of the Legislative Auditor.
Representative Joachim?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know, Mr. Nobles, you requested some information from CTIB and received a report in a quick turnaround. I think it was like 2 weeks. Was there any information that you didn't get that wasn't readily available that you would need?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Nobles.
I think we were completely satisfied with the information that we received from CTIB. This this bill, though, gives us an ongoing responsibility. So I think that request that we made kind of gets us prepared. We have dealt, again, with CTIB, with all of these various regional organizations on transit before, so I think we're fairly familiar with the financial arrangements and prepared to do this work if it's the request of the legislature that we do it.
Thank you.
Do you
have another follow-up?
No, I can save it for
Thank you. Representative Bernardi. Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking forward to hearing the testifiers as well, but I didn't actually hear what the concern is that you're trying to get at that doesn't come out of the annual legislative auditor's report. I didn't hear what the problem is that's being addressed here.
Mr. Chair, I think that's really a question for the author of the bill.
Chair Runbeck?
We have five different entities, in CTIB and assets, totaling multi-millions of dollars. And how will those be, distributed when the organization is no longer, if that's the case? In the interim, the Joint Powers Agreement says very little about the disillusionment. I mean, what takes place? So is there a given date that members, need to be notifying the chair that this is what they choose to do? What happens to projects that are under consideration? What projects, say, in one county or another might be thrown into the pile so that the members then have that obligation and that debt. Going forward, if some counties are considering a quarter cent tax, others are considering a half cent tax, some of those questions, I think, are part of this whole issue and are really needed to be looked at. So it's far more than a financial audit. Is probably what I'm saying.
Okay. Representative Bernardi, follow-up?
Yes, I do have a follow-up. So my question is, the legislative auditor talked about, Office of Legislative Auditor, Mr. Nobles talked about how this is like a special project or something. That's what I see the legislative auditor coming in and reviewing something, and not an ongoing basis. This is a quarterly basis. This is like growing government, and I'm just wondering, why isn't it focused on one special one-time audit, but and not this continuing audits every quarter, which seems like it's overkill when we haven't really identified what we're not currently getting out of the legislative audit report.
Mr. Chair,
Noble?
Representatives, well, we're currently not producing a legislative auditor's report on CTIP. I mean, we've done evaluations in the past at the direction of the legislature about regional transit planning, regional transit operations, and a variety of other transit issues. And I don't read the bill as being an audit requirement. It's a financial review with a list of questions and issues that we are supposed to look at and simply provide analysis and information to the legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. One more follow-up.
Okay, well, as I understand, it's financials of both the Transit Division and the Met Council and the County Transit Improvement Board. And we already have a legislative auditor who does that work. So I don't
state.
So state, excuse me, getting close to the same names. We already have a state auditor who does that work and has a very efficient at it and provides us information. And I'm not understanding why we're growing government and putting quarterly reviews by a new entity in government to do this.
Oh, maybe I should answer that.
Chair Lombard.
First of all, as we've said, it's not just a financial statement. It's not a financial audit. It's more. It's analysis of what the current revenues are, what the forecasted revenues might be over the next, 3 months, maybe until they would dissolve, that sort of thing. So it's beyond what is included in a financial audit. And if you, I was sent the link is for the last financial audit, which is available for the Met Council, and that is dated December 31st, 2015. I think they're in the habit of doing it once a year. Now, here's a situation, unique. We want, something on a more current basis to really know what kind of money we're dealing with. Maybe there's a final audit after the dissolution, that kind of thing. So that's, I think, a very good reason to be suggesting that we need the help of the legislative auditor.
Thank you. Representative Joachim?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the bill, actually, Representative Runbeck. We keep talking, switching back and forth between Metropolitan Council and CTIP. CTIP is talking about dissolution. Metropolitan Council is not. On lines 2.25, you add Metropolitan Council to this financial activity reporting. And I'm just curious because, as Representative Bernardi said, the state auditor does a very extensive PAFR. For those of you who've been on a city council or a county, you're used to seeing these documents. The PAFR report on everything the Met Council does, with lots of details on financials in here. And in fact, they've received a certificate of achievement for excellence from the Government Financial Officers Association on it. So I guess I don't understand why you're kind of lumping Met Council and CTIP, when they're different entities, into adding them into this quarterly report when there's already a very extensive financial audit done.
And Mr. Chair and Representative, it's that nexus. I mean, where these two are joined together in the projects for the funding is coming from CTIB, in other cases where they're granting to Met Council funds. Okay, so they are kind of one entity at times, and other times they're not. So that's what we need to know more about. And I mean, I'm looking at some documents that are from the 2015 audit, and statements several times occur in this memo about the Met Council audit, where the state auditor is saying, we do not express an opinion on the effectiveness of the council's internal control over financial reporting. It occurs again. We don't, we're not here to provide an opinion on the effectiveness of the council's internal control over financial reporting, and so on and so forth. So, it doesn't give you much depth. I mean, that's sort of the issue. So, the preference, in my view, is that we have the Office of the Legislative Auditor. We know the kind of work they do. We know the depth that they are willing to go to find the answers, and the leadership that they're willing to give the legislature on the path ahead. And in the case of CTIB, you know, it's I haven't seen any other bills about CTIB and what might happen. And frankly, I think it's not enough to let CTIB simply dissolve. The legislature must put its oar in the water on this issue and make some determinations.
Thank you, Chair Rumbeck. One last follow-up.
One just quick clarifying question. I know when a state audit, when an audit is done, and as in the CAFR, a lot of the times when the entity doing the audit says they don't express an opinion, it's because they found nothing wrong with it. So I just wanted to throw that out there. And I'm still having a hard time understanding why Met Council is being lumped in with CTIB. I understand that you're worried about CTIB dissolving, and it's a very extensive joint powers agreement that talks about that, and I'm sure we can discuss that when I offer my amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Mason.
Just a follow-up. Since both the chair and I are from Dakota County, maybe he might want to make some comments, but there is a formula when they leave CTIB, so that is just going through that and following the procedure. It's just you need more than that. What is it you're looking for?
Representative Mason, one moment. I don't believe, it's not my understanding that there is a formula how they disperse and agree on dispersing the funds if there is a dissolution. So I think that's a little bit something to,
okay.
Other than the, you know, current obligations, and I believe a testifier coming up later may be able to address that, probably may talk about that.
Okay, let me just rephrase that. I know that Dakota County knows what its obligations are as it is leaving. So there is something set up.
And Representative, and Mr. Chair, Representative, I think we owe it to the member counties. I think we owe it to taxpayers to really get into the depths of where the money's been going, what is being paid, what is being debt serviced. I mean, what is that obligation of each of these counties? I think there's a lot more questions than to simply say, okay, you're going to pay X amount for 2 years or 5 years. I think there's a lot more to it. So I think this is an opportunity to make sure, to give the county some assurance that all the questions have been answered.
Okay, thank you, Chair Rumbeck. I know we've got on here Mary Richards, CTIB Administrator, and then Rebecca Otto, State Auditor, and Mr. Shetman standing up there. Okay, so we'll proceed with those testifiers. Mr. Nobles, did you have?
Just end by making one clarification. The reference was made to the CAFR audit. That's an audit of the annual financial statements of an organization. I don't see anything in here that would have us duplicate that. I mean, the state auditor does the audit. The bill does not remove that in a different chapter of state law. This simply adds the Metropolitan Council to us to do additional work beyond the CAFR work as resources permit. So we have no intention of redoing the CAFR audit.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Ms. Richards, if you'd come forward, identify yourself for the record, and present your testimony, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, my name is Mary Richards' son, and I am the administrator of CTIB. I am a principal in the firm of Richardson, Richter & Associates, and my firm has been retained to provide administrative services to CTIB. I have with me Kathy Aho, who is the president of Springstead Incorporated. She has been retained by CTIB to provide the independent municipal advisory services. She's a financial advisor to CTIB, so in the event you have questions about numbers, we've got Kathy with us as well. So,
very
Mr.
good.
Chair?
Yep. Please proceed.
I would like to describe a little bit about the procedures and policies of CTIB for the management review, audit, oversight, and overall management of the board's financial activities. All of the board's policies and procedures have been developed over the last 9 years to ensure compliance with CTIB's statutory authority, generally accepted accounting standards, and full transparency. CTIB's financial information is submitted to the legislature annually, as our statute requires an annual report. That report contains much of the information listed in the bill in terms of grants and obligations, resources, and expenditures. In addition, we are audited annually by the state auditor, as was discussed here. We have had an audit every year with an unqualified or clean result. And I think it's important to know that our board oversees the financial activity of CTIB on a monthly basis. As been discussed, we've had a recent request from the legislative auditor for our financial management information, and I have brought copies that have been distributed to you of the cover letter that went along with that response. I also have a box filled with the response of several hundred pages of financial information, which I have not copied for all of the committee members, but we'll leave it for you for your records.
Thank you.
So let me describe CTIB and how it works, and I think it's very pertinent to the conversation about the dissolution of CTIB. CTIB is a joint powers board, and it's established pursuant to the authorizing legislation that was adopted in 2008, but it was also established pursuant to Minnesota statutes section 471.59, which authorizes counties to enter into joint powers agreements by the development of a contract. And CTIB did this in 2008 after careful negotiations. The board that was established pursuant to this agreement consists of two elected county commissioners from each of the five counties. As you know, it's Anoka, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington. It also has the chair of the Metropolitan Council as a member of the board. This is a requirement of state statute. The board is staffed by a team of senior administrative and finance officials from each of the five counties, as well as from the Metropolitan Council and Metro Transit as needed for coordination. My firm coordinates the finance staff. The board is limited by its authorizing legislation to an annual administrative budget of 0.75% of the net proceeds of the sales tax. Within that budget, the board contracts for professional services for administration, trustee services, bond counsel services, independent municipal advisory services, and independent technical advice, all as needed to manage the financial activity of the board. Hennepin County acts as the fiscal manager of the board, and its financial management and contracting practices are followed by CTIB, pursuant to an agreement that was entered into between CTIB and the county.
Could I just interrupt for a second?
Yes.
Can you just expound on that a little bit or clarify what you said about Hennepin County's the fiscal management and what does that pertain?
Most joint powers boards have an agreement with one of its member counties to establish the financial management, accounting, and contracting procedures. CTIB chose to enter into that agreement with Hennepin County because they have the resources to manage it. So, for example, their procurement policies with respect to contracting, we follow. Their form contracts for professional services, we follow. Their auditor, the internal auditor, and accounting departments monitor the disbursement of our funds. They don't have independent decision-making authority over the use of CTIP funds, but they do the accounting and contracting procedures. Their county attorney's office advises the CTIP board on board actions.
Okay. Please proceed. Thank you.
In addition to Hennepin County, the sales tax revenues that are received and generated by the quarter cent sales tax are deposited with a trustee. And there is a trust agreement that carefully lays out the disbursement procedures that the trustee must follow in terms of distributing CTIP funds. So in summary, the county's senior financial and administrative officials, our independent financial and legal expertise, a trustee, and the financial management expertise of Hennepin County, which is, by the way, a AAA-rated county, together ensure that the county's board's finances are scrutinized, managed with prudence, and with the highest degree of care, as is appropriate for a joint powers board that's managing the oversight of substantial taxpayer dollars. So I want to read briefly the board's policy on financial management, because this, I think, is a theme that carries throughout the work of the board. The board's financial business will be conducted with transparency and in accordance with budgeting, accounting, banking, auditing, and financial management standards consistent with those expected of the individual government member organizations. These standards reflect the fact that the five member counties enjoy exceptionally high bond ratings, with four of them rated triple high, or triple A, by one or more of the national rating agencies. The point is, CTIB's finances are managed with significant oversight and care. The Department of Revenue collects the quarter-cent sales tax, as I'm sure you're aware. The funds are remitted to the trustee, and receipts are carefully monitored by our finance team to assess any irregularities in collection and to evaluate whether growth rates are consistent with projections and to determine whether CTIP's sole revenue stream is sufficient to meet its obligations in the current year and in accordance with the long-range plan. I think the fact that CTIP has a long-range plan with a prescribed number of corridors, a limited number of corridors, is oftentimes lost in the dialogue. CTIB has a financial plan that manages or balances projected revenues, the need for debt, and the funding commitments and the capital and operating funding needs of our projects over the next 50 years. Kathy Aho's firm does a financial analysis and has developed a very complicated financial model that the board relies on in its determination of the funding that it makes available to the counties or to the Metropolitan Council for the development of the projects. The plan serves as the foundation for the annual grants process, which is required by our authorizing legislation. And each year, the board's independent financial advisor, in conjunction with our finance team, updates the plan and transmits to the board for adoption. I could go through the elements of this plan in the grant process, but in the interest of time, I'll move ahead and say that it is a very thorough process. We are required by state statute to do a grant solicitation process, and the board does that once a year. The whole basis of that plan is our long-range funding plan to determine whether or not we can afford the grants that are being proposed to us. Grant applications are accepted in the fall. The finance team provides the initial review, and then as required by law, the Metropolitan Council reviews the grants for consistency with its transportation policy plan, so our plans are joined. The GEARS committee reviews it, recommends specific projects, and each board presents its application. Each project presents its application to the board. Grants are awarded in November, and grant agreements that binds up the funds are executed in December. So, in summary, the board's financial activity is carefully prescribed by statute, by policy, by best financial management practices, and by active board oversight. The board is staffed by some of the best financial minds or professionals in the state of Minnesota. And so while we willingly make the board's information available for review, and it's on our website as well, the proposed financial report by the legislative auditor appears to us to be duplicative and unnecessary because of the good financial oversight that is employed by CTIB currently. Another layer of reporting is not going to materially improve the level of information available to the counties or the county taxpayers. We believe this will add costs not only to the state at the Office of the Legislative Auditor, it will add costs to CTIB in compliance. And finally, and most importantly, I think, the bill requires that OLA provide its report to the member counties of CTIB to assist the counties in their determination of whether to terminate the joint powers agreement that they negotiated and entered into. Moreover, it prohibits the counties from taking action on termination for 4 weeks following the receipt of that report. We don't support this provision for the following reason. It seems unnecessary because the CTIP counties are CTIP. The CTIP county staff provide the staff work to CTIP. The CTIP, all of the counties have independent financial advisors that are advising them on this termination. So the additional assistance from the Office of the Legislative Auditor appears to us to be unnecessary. I think that it's important to say that CTIB is committed to managing its affairs, including the dissolution, with fiscal prudence and full transparency. All of the questions that you have raised, we have answers for and are willing to provide those answers, because the dissolution process, while not finalized, is being considered very carefully by CTIB and its member counties. Those counties entered into the Joint Powers Agreement in 2008 in accordance with state law.
Ms. Richardson, are we wrapping up here?
I'm almost done.
Thank you.
Sorry. I just want to say that the agreement was negotiated, approved, and executed by each of the five county boards, and that agreement includes a termination clause and an understanding of what happens upon termination. They entered into the agreement in reliance upon that termination clause, knowing they could withdraw, as Dakota County did, or they could terminate the agreement. The county shouldn't be prohibited or delayed in their ability to freely exercise their contractual rights under that agreement. For what we deem to be a relatively unnecessary purpose. So, in closing, we would oppose this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Aho?
Aho.
Aho, I'm sorry. Did you have anything different to add?
No, Mr. Chair, I did not.
Okay, maybe you could just stick around as a resource if we have some questions. State Auditor Otto? Okay, she's on the list. I don't see her. Well, Mr. Shetman, thank you. Appreciate your testimony. And Mr. Shetman, welcome back to the testifiers table. If we could try to be as concise. We've been here quite a while today, and I'd like to try to have member questions if there are some, and then, stay concise, please.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will do my best to stay concise. There are a number of bills related to my council today, so I just want to make sure
that and I we're glad you're here. We appreciate your time, but I'm just trying to manage everybody else's day as well, so thank you.
Well, thank you. So I will be brief. I think there was a question asked earlier by a couple of the members that were raising the question about what is not being reported in the state auditor's report that the legislative auditor would be able to find and provide that information, because it was mentioned earlier, and it's correct, that the council is audited by the state auditor. We actually have staff embedded at the council who provide all of this information on a regular basis to the state. And so what the council, our reason for opposing this bill is because we do find it to be redundant. Another thing I mentioned in one of the other bills today, I talked about the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Governance. In that commission, we provide to the legislature a copy of our draft unified budget and then come back before the council adopts our budget. That is a great time for us to work with the legislature and those 14 metro area members to talk about questions and concerns that they may have. And we are absolutely open to having any of these conversations. But regarding House File 1160, I cannot figure out what is what we're missing as far as what Representative Rumbeck is looking for. So maybe if she could articulate what the council is missing in our reporting. We don't have to do it now, but it would be I would like to hear what additional layer of information she's looking for, because the council is not CTIB, and I know that has been discussed about how they do that. And so I think we just need a little bit better understanding of what you're looking for, because I think if we spent a little time talking about it, we may be able to provide you the comfort in knowing that we already provide it. And if you are looking for that additional information, there are the proper channels for us to be able to provide that without having a second, audit required.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Shetman.
And,
I was just going to mention there's another amendment, but you want to comment to that, Madam Chair? Madam Chair, did you have comments back to Mr. Shetman's comments?
That's not my amendment.
No, I understand. But I was giving you an opportunity to reply back to Mr. Shetman's comments.
Well, and
Thank you for the testimony. Thanks for the folks that have been here, are here tonight, the legislative auditor, Mary Richardson, and so on. And, you know, I think that that we will be able to sit down and discuss really what kinds of information really are needed to be looked at. What is the, you know, the end game going to how that will be spelled out. So between those three different entities, you know, I'm happy to do some more work and see just exactly, you know, if we do have enough with the resources available, or if it would be helpful to have a second opinion, to have the legislative auditor weigh in and, you know, bring us some additional recommendations perhaps. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. We have Representative Hornstein has a question.
No, thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I, you know, concur with some of the observations around this work being a little bit redundant because, or this bill being redundant because we do have the state auditor. And, you know, the legislative auditor does great things. A fantastic, stellar job on this recent transportation MnDOT audit of, you know, that included some issues around criteria for how we choose to fund road projects. The legislative auditor did a great job 5 years ago on transit, and I think now we're final transit governance. Now I think we're finally getting around to maybe acting on some of the legislative auditor's recommendation on governance reform. But I worry about using the legislative auditor for this purpose. Mr. Shetman had mentioned the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Governance. That's a very unique thing. We don't have a Legislative Commission on that. See, now I think I'm going to give the majority some ideas here, so maybe I should stop. We don't have a Legislative Commission on the Pollution Control Agency or the DNR or Ag or anything like that. And so, but we do have it for this level of government because some issues have been raised about it. And so we scrutinize the budget. I've been on the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Governance every year since I've been here, and we scrutinize every December their budget. We've had, you know, a lot of a discussion about that, and as we do when we go over the budget every biennium for the in the larger transportation bill. So I just worry about overusing the auditor when we already have some systems in place to really scrutinize this situation here. So I hope that we'll be very careful about moving forward with this.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. We're going to go to Representative Yochiman. Do you want to introduce your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to introduce my amendment, but also like to just point out maybe if there's something in the statute that Representative Runbeck is not finding that they need, that this needs to be in there. But CTIP, when it was created in 297A.992, it spells out, you know, how you terminate the taxes, how they have to report every year on February 1st, the duties of the Joint Powers Agreement. It even spells out in there how they have to lay out and be disclosed the grants they're giving to the MAC Council. It also notes 471.59, which is the just general Joint Powers Agreement for any two governmental entities that join into one. And that also requires a termination agreement and distribution of properties after something's terminated. So there is stuff in statute and within the Joint Powers Agreement that does that. My concern in my amendment, why I've proposed it, is to basically subdivision 2 under Section 4, 3.25 through 3.28, actually goes up to 3.23 with some amendment changes. But this subdivision actually, once again, jumps in to a local joint powers agreement that was created and disallows them from dissolving after the fact, after they've set forward and done everything that they're supposed to, required by statute. Joint powers agreements are really important for communities. I know we have, our city councils have them with counties, with our fire, with our police. It's how we function and become more efficient together. And the state's always talking about efficiency as in wanting city councils and governments to work together. By passing bills like this, I think you're setting a dangerous precedent and the state being able to go back and just totally erase those joint powers agreements that those two counties have done or two units of government have done together, or retroactively stalling them from doing their work. And that's why I'm proposing A1, because that's what this section does. It says, okay, guys, I know you did these joint powers agreements and you laid out all the terms and you were going by this contract and you have contractual rights. We're just going to take those away. And I worry that cities and counties will be really hesitant going forward to enter into these joint powers agreements because of something like this. So I'd like to propose the A1 amendment.
Thank you. Representative Joachim moves the amendment. Madam Chair?
I would accept it as a friendly amendment.
Okay. Okay. Chair Rumbeck accepts the amendment as a friendly amendment. Everyone should have a copy in their packets. Any further discussion on this amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify? Mr. Carney? I kind of went out of order a little bit previous, but I see Mr. Carney, and then I think we're close to wrapping this bill up then.
So hi, Bobby Dean Carney, Jr., registered lobbyist for We the People. Just a couple of brief comments. First of all, CTIB has been responsible for about 30% of the total dollars going into these light rail projects. That's about 60% of all the local money. I've been to their meetings. There is no electronic record of those meetings. They do not tape record them. They do not videotape them. You're looking at the Southwest Light Rail project with a potential overrun, partly due to this tunnel project that they're talking about in Kenilworth. I've got a tape recording of the Transportation Committee Chair of the Minneapolis City Council, Kevin Wright, asking him what's going to happen if you can't build this. That council's already on record as saying that they'd have to go through another municipal consent process. Very briefly, there's a huge legal risk of cost overruns if this thing blows up. And that alone seems to me to be an absolutely compelling reason to take a look proactively at some of the things that the state that the legislative auditor would look at on this, because we're really looking at some potential legal landmines here. Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony, Mr. Carney. Members, are there? I don't see any questions on there. I did have a question for Ms. Richardson, if she's still back here. If you don't mind, thank you. Thank you for coming back here. How much approximately cash on hand is there in CTIB right now, or as of your last report? And that doesn't have to be exact. I know, kind of.
Mr. Chair, the cash balance of our trust account is around $280 million. Of that amount, when you count the debt and the grant agreements that have been entered into for 2017, that's fully committed.
Okay, can you restate that last part? When you count the
debt? The $100 million.
So those are planned projects?
No, that was debt issued in 2010 for the Central Corridor project, outstanding approximately $100 million of debt. And then we have entered into grant agreements for projects for 2017. So in combination, all of CTIB's cash reserves are committed by agreement for expenditure in 2017.
Okay. So the cash agreements, Ms. Richardson, then, the grant agreements were recently entered into. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. They followed the grant solicitation process that I described in my testimony. The grant agreement or the grant awards were made in December this year, the agreements in January. There was a one-month delay because our November meeting was canceled, but that was consistent with our typical process.
Okay. Well, thank you for answering that. And I think part of the problem, members, is that, you know, it's kind of like a couple's getting divorced, and the quick before you decide to get divorced, you run up the credit card bills and use up all the cash. And so I think that's where there's some questions remain with CTIB. But Ms. Richardson, I appreciate answering the question. I don't see any other questions. Is there?
I'm sorry.
I did tell you that I would like to. Yes, go ahead, Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I wanted to thank Representative Runbeck for accepting the amendment because I do believe in transparency, too, and I like it. I like what some of your bill is getting to and having some of those quarterly reports. I just wanted to thank you on the record. And then I had a question for Ms. Richardson real quick. Just from what I heard you say, I know Mr. Chair mentioned that it was like a divorce and you quick run up those bills, but how long does that grant process take from start to end? And when the grant agreements that you just okayed in your last meeting, when did that process actually start?
It started last spring, and actually the programs or the projects that we're monitoring, we do on an annual basis, so these are all part of our program of projects, but the grant process for 2017 grants started last spring in the collection of the data.
Spring of 2016, Mr. Chair, then that would be spring of 2016?
Yes.
All right,
yes.
Thank you.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Ms. Richardson. When did the discussion for the possible dissolution of CTIB start?
Ms. Richardson?
Mr. Chair, the board started having workshops on the issue in December of 2017. Dakota County withdrew from CTIB last summer, or they filed notice. It's a 2.5-year notice period. But the termination of CTIB, that discussion started in December.
Thank you. Representative Barr?
Do you have a more specific, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a more specific date for the, other than summer? And I do think you meant December 2016.
I'm sorry.
Not 17. That's okay.
Yes.
Ms. Richardson?
Mr. Chair, I believe we received the notice of termination in mid-June of 2016. The board's first workshop on the dissolution was on December 1st of 2016.
Please follow up. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why the delay for the December workshop to discuss the dissolution?
Mr. Chair, in the interim, CTIP spent a number of months looking at proposed ways to modify its program of projects to address the fact that we would be losing 13% of our revenues. In September of 2016, the board adopted its annual update to the investment strategy, cutting some lines that went into Dakota County and cutting the contributions to the Riverview Corridor. It made those sorts of adjustments, developed a plan that we thought would be viable, but then the discussion started coming up about whether the dissolution might provide for a smoother path to funding these projects.
No, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Richardson. Seeing no other questions from members. Was there one? No? I will renew Chair Runbeck's motion that House File 1160 be laid over as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thanks for your patience, members.
Representative Hornstein, I believe your bill will be next.
And Mr. Chair, Madam Chair is back. Madam Chair is back.
Representative Hornstein.
So I think I'm last but not least here. Are we done after this? Yeah.
Representative, do you want to? Yeah, you can move your bill, Representative.
Okay, thanks, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 829 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Transportation Policy Bill. That's what it's called. Metropolitan Governance Bill, perhaps?
Some fancy name, you bet.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair, and I do very much appreciate your hearing this bill. As I've mentioned before to other members, Metropolitan Governance Reform has been something that I've been a part of since I arrived here, and I am very hopeful that something will come out of this hearing today that will be meaningful and that perhaps the governor can advance as well, because I think there is some bipartisan interest in metropolitan governance reform. And so I have House File 829. I also have an elected Met Council bill. I also have a bill that forms a study committee to look at possible models for metropolitan governance. So I have a trifecta, so hopefully we can hear the other two. But today, members, this is a bill that actually I want to give credit where credit is due. Representative Albright and I believe Representative Nash had something very similar last year. And so I'm just taking the torch with from them. And basically there's just two parts of the bill. One is to provide staggered terms, staggered four-year terms. And what this does is we have, in the event that we have a change in gubernatorial philosophy, it's not a dramatic change. We still have folks left over from previous administration and then others that will be served by a potentially new governor. And then we have a process to really, I think, more thoroughly vet Met Council nominees. And we give local governments the opportunity to weigh in. And this becomes, I think, a much more inclusive process, again, where the locals are really available to not only suggest and nominate nominees, but to really vet them. So this moves us forward from, I think, a direct gubernatorial process to actually having some input from our the municipalities that, as has been pointed out, I think on numerous occasions today, Madam Chair, have a real vested interest in that council deliberation. So I do have a couple of brief testifiers, if you want to take them or have the committee ask me questions, I'd be happy to do what you want.
First want to do your amendments. I think you have one and then possibly an oral one.
Yes. I have the A3 amendment, Madam Chair, and this just deletes the section on the task force on SAC charges because it's my understanding that there was one already, and so that work was completed, and Metro Cities can talk a little bit more about that, but I feel that was a little bit redundant. We don't really need that at this point.
Okay. Any comments or discussion? Those in favor of the A3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Same sign, nay.
Madam Chair, I have one more short oral amendment, and it actually came from a constituent who took a look at my bill, and it relates to Subdivision 2 of this Equity Advisory Committee. And let's see the exact citation here. So this would be under Subdivision 2, Line 2, so that's 4.7 and 4.8. On 4.8, after job centers and high growth centers, you can add educational opportunities at all levels. So basically we're looking at educational institutions as part of this mix as well.
Representative, then, are you saying after the semicolon?
Yes.
And educational centers?
Yep. Educational opportunities at all levels was the wording that I was given.
Okay. All right. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of the oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment prevails. And did you have any are there questions from the committee about the bill? Any other comments?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Again, it's a step forward, I believe, in terms of governance reform. And I wanted to point out, because I've, again, the Citizens League and Metro Cities, a lot of this comes out of a stakeholder process, which you'll hear a little bit more about from Mr. Kershaw. And so we're just kind of implementing some of their recommendations.
Very good. Mr. Kershaw, would you like to come present your comments? Welcome to the committee. You've sat here a long time. Welcome.
I'm going to take it first.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, which, as I mentioned earlier here today, represents cities in the seven-county metropolitan area at both the legislature and the Metropolitan Council. And I do have written copies of our position, too, if Paige would be so kind as to hand those out when she's available. Metro Cities does support provisions in this bill relating to the governance of the Metropolitan Council, specifically the appointment of members by the governor with four-year staggered terms. This is an issue, as I mentioned earlier with Representative Albright's bill, that Metro Cities has had some significant discussion in the last several years on the topic of regional governance. And through both a task force and several policy committee iterations on this topic, the result has been a policy that supports the four-year staggered terms for members, which we believe will stabilize potential ideological shifts that occur when members are appointed coterminous with the governor, and also provide for a continuity of knowledge on the council, which we believe is appropriate for a long-range planning body. Metro Cities also supports improvements to the nominating or selection process for Metropolitan Council members. Under current law, the governor is required to appoint a seven-person nominating committee that makes recommendations on members for appointment. We would like to see that committee expanded to 13 members, with the majority of those members being local officials. And actually, we would take it a step further to say that we believe those local officials should be appointed by Metro Cities and the County Association. The bill does provide for an expansion of the nominating committee, and it does provide transparency in the processes, essentially requiring the recommendations to become public, which we do support. I think I will leave it there. For a second there. Madam Chair, the provision in the bill that relates to the SAC task force, as Representative Hornstein has pointed out, there is a SAC task force that was appointed that consists of city officials and business representation that was appointed after discussion by the legislature last year to take a look at outdoor seating capacity and SAC. So that task force has made a recommendation along that line. I can get into that or not. And it also is continuing to meet to discuss some other provisions of the SAC program. So we do support, we don't believe that the bill meets that provision. Thank you, Madam.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Now, Mr. Kershaw, welcome. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sean Kershaw. I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens League. What I will do, you have the recommendations, I believe, in front of you, as well as the members of the task force. I'm just going to talk briefly about the process. That most of the outcomes from our process are included in Representative Hornstein's bill. We put together a committee starting in September of 2015. The committee concluded its work in February of 2016 and made its recommendations at that time. They were included in one of the Senate bills last year and partially in one of the House bills last year. I don't have to tell you at whatever 7 o'clock or whatever it is tonight that the Met Council is a topic that brings out strong opinions on all sides, because it's an important body for the health of the state. We were deliberate in putting together the panel, the group of people that you have on your list, to reflect a variety of different ideologies, different sectors, different opinions, people who had a great deal of experience with the Metropolitan Council, people who had no experience with it, and looked at this issue, looked at the governing issues that had come up over this period of time and made these recommendations. The three criteria they used for their final recommendations, I think, are important to stress, which guide what finally came out. It was important to the members of the committee, that, and they all agreed, that the recommendations have to address the concerns that have been raised, which you have been talking about this afternoon. The recommendations should preserve the ability of the Metropolitan Council to meet its original statutory mission, and the recommendations should be politically practical or plausible. It should be possible in the political environment we're in to move them forward. And I think you'll find the fact that given the committee membership, that we think that it reflects ultimately what we think is possible. Not what everybody wanted, you know, if you ask people individually on the committee, but what they agreed as a group was in the best interests of the region and the state to meet those criteria.
Very good. Are there any questions of Mr. Kershaw? Any questions of the author? Okay. If not, we will go ahead and we will. I will re. Well, you can renew your motion.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'd like to renew my motion that House File 829 be laid over for possible inclusion in a policy bill, future policy bill.
Thank you very much. I think we are concluded. There is nothing else on the agenda, or did you have something,
Madam Chair,
Representative?
While I'm here. Thank you very much. Just one more minute, Madam Chair, while I'm here. I know that towards the end, in the interest of time, I had a very quick comment on the bill related to fare box recovery. And I just wanted to share that with you on the record.
Right.
I don't know if you want me to
Please
do it here or move over there.
Feel free to go ahead, Representative.
Members, I did want to express my deep concerns and opposition to that bill, even though I know it's laid over for possible inclusion. We are talking about fares that could rise to the $4 and $5 level as a result of this. And I've been to a lot of transportation meetings over the years, but there's one line that always sticks out for me, and someone was testifying at a field hearing that we did a number of years ago and said, what good is a job if I can't get there? And I think this is going to really inhibit a lot of people who are working two and three jobs just to get by, just to feed their families and provide shelter and housing and health care. This is going to be a tremendous, tremendous burden and problem for people. And so I think we need to do all we can to make sure our transportation and transit systems are efficient and well-run, but I don't believe that the Uglin bill will get us there and, in fact, will, I think, deter a number of people from riding transit, such as my constituents that ride with me on the number 6 bus, a lot of 20-somethings that are riding to their first jobs, often at Target and other corporations, I think are going to really feel the pinch from that type of bill. So I hope that... while it's being considered for possible inclusion, I hope it will not be included ultimately in our bill. So thank you for
Thank you, Representative Hornstein, for your comments. And thanks to the committee for a tremendous amount of patience tonight. We appreciate it. And that concludes our agenda for today. We are adjourned.